strike if it doesn't happen soon, he says. A massive armada is heading to the Middle East, ready, willing and able to inflict speed and violence if necessary. Iran responds by saying its military has the finger on the trigger and will respond and react immediately and powerfully. But would you like to see Trump strike Iran and potentially try to topple the repressive regime there? And if he does, should Britain join America?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Iran says it stands ready for talks over its nuclear program, but will defend itself if pushed following renewed threats from Donald Trump. The US president says a massive armada is heading to the Middle East and time is running out to reach a deal. Professor Ali Ansari is the director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He's told LBC he thinks the regime is feeling enough pressure from within the country and Donald Trump could just stand back.
If Donald Trump decided just to sit back and blockade the country or to sort of really reinforce and enforce, shall we say, the oil sanctions that the US have on Iran, that would probably do sufficient damage to the regime, actually. I mean, they're under an enormous amount of pressure at the moment, and they're not loved, clearly. Mm. You know, their options are running out.
At least two federal agents who were involved in the shooting dead of a US citizen in Minneapolis on Saturday have been suspended. US media is reporting they were put on leave as part of standard procedures following Alex Pretty's death. Earlier, President Trump said his administration will de-escalate a little bit following an angry response to the actions of ICE agents. LBC's Washington correspondent Simon Marks isn't convinced.
I think he wants to divert people's attention away from Minneapolis so that he can try and bury these questions about whether he's going to fire key members of his inner circle, because Kristi Noem indicated last night everything she said last weekend when she was slandering Alex Pretty, everything she said she was directed to say. So that's a massive problem for the White House.
The Prime Minister says it's in the UK's interest to engage with China. Sir Keir Starmer is hoping to strengthen business ties with the country during his three-day visit, the first since Theresa May in 2018. And deep and fast flowing water following Storm Chandra has caused a danger to life flood warning to be issued for a holiday park in Dorset. People living at the site in Christchurch have been told they'll likely spend tonight away from their home. In the city, the FTSE 100's closed down 53 points at 10,154. The pound buys $1.37 and €1.15. LBC weather. Fog lingering in central and eastern areas tomorrow. Mostly cloudy with the odd bright spell in places. Some light rain in northeast Scotland and the southwest. A high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ben Kentish.
It is 2 minutes after 10. Hello there. A very, very good evening to you. Lovely to have you with us tonight, where you are listening to Late Nights with Ben Kentish here on LBC. Lots for us to get into between now and 1 o'clock. On tonight's show,
it's concerning how much everyone around football regulation, on the one hand, say they want to keep football out of politics, yet are pushing it right into politics.
Call today for England fans and those from other nations to boycott next year's World Cup in North America. Do those making that case seriously want to deprive us all of the joy of a World Cup summer just to send an empty message to Donald Trump? It's a terrible idea if you ask me, but I want your thoughts on that after 11. Plus,
governments just seem to be tinkering rather than looking in the round about how to make university finances sustainable and make it fairer for graduates.
Nick Clegg there admitting that students are effectively being ripped off by the current student loan system, which he says needs an overhaul. But our Chancellor Rachel Reeves tells LBC that hitting young grads with massive debts and punishing interest rates is fair. So who's right on that one? You're called a little later in the programme. And
Holocaust Memorial Day, a day for remembering the 6 million people who were murdered by the Nazi regime over 80 years ago.
Why the BBC has had to apologise to Britain's Jewish community yet again, this time over its coverage of Holocaust Memorial Day.
Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. This is LBC.
We start tonight with a sobering warning today from Donald Trump. Time is running out, the US president says, for Iran to strike a deal relating to its nuclear program, or else. And the "or else" from Donald Trump is laid out pretty starkly. He says a massive armada, and he's referring to the US Navy here, a massive armada is heading to the Middle East, in the words of Trump, ready, willing and able to rapidly fulfil its mission with speed and violence if necessary. So it's pretty clear, isn't it? It's pretty clear cut what he's trying to say. Hurry up, strike some sort of agreement, come to the table, let's do a deal on this. So you agree to scale back, if not stop completely, your nuclear weapons program, or I am ready and willing and certainly able to take mighty military action against you. And we don't know what that military action might look like. It might just be another set of airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, like we saw last year. It could go further. Trump has previously suggested that he would try and help the protesters trying to topple the Iranian regime. So we could see, just like we saw in Venezuela, Trump actively getting involved, potentially, to try to enact regime change in Iran for the first time since the revolution in 1979. The question then becomes, I think, what are the rest of the US allies? If America does launch some sort of military strikes against Iran, whatever those strikes look like, what does Britain do? Because obviously we went to the US's aid in Afghanistan. We joined forces with them in Iraq. I don't think there's any serious prospect of troops being sent on the ground in Iran, although who knows with Trump. But if there is some sort of military action short of an invasion, what should Britain do about it? Tell me your thoughts on that. Should the US take military action? If Trump does declare tomorrow or next week or maybe next month or any minute he sees fit that he is taking military action against the Iranian regime, is that something you would welcome and like to see? Should the US be jumping to the aid and the support of the Iranian protesters that are, you know, putting their lives on the line, in tens of thousands of their cases, losing their lives in order to try to bring down one of the most brutal, repressive regimes on the face of this planet? Or should America stay well out of it? And if America and the, if Trump does take action, what should Keir Starmer and Britain do about it? Should we support it? Should we join forces with Trump and try and restore, you know, some semblance of Iran as a country that is free and fair, where people don't have to live their lives in fear as they currently do? Or is it simply none of our business at all? Call me. Should the US take military action against Iran? Would you like to see that happen? And if it does happen, and I think it's very possible, if not plausible, that Trump does that, should Britain support it or not? Let me know. 0345 60 60 973. Would love to hear your thoughts on both of those questions tonight. You can text me if you like on 84850. You can also send an Alexa message by saying, Alexa, send a comment to LBC. Calls coming in already on that. We'll talk to a US diplomat who's worked for five US administrations in just a moment. First, though, Rob McCare joins me, former British ambassador to Iran between 2018 and 2021. Rob, great to have you on the programme tonight. We'll come on to your sort of opinion on whether it should happen in a moment. But first, do you think it will? Do you think some sort of military action from the US is more likely than not as we speak tonight?
Well, I think, Ben, the first point is really that it's probably a mistake to think that there's a major US grand strategy that is unfolding before our eyes. This is a president who's made a virtue, of course, of unpredictability, of keeping his adversaries off guard, and I think what we're seeing now is the president keeping optionality, keeping the options to take military action. So I think it'd be a brave person to predict exactly what's going to happen, because it may be that that decision has not even been taken by President Trump himself. So I would say that the comments that he's made about going back into nuclear talks, and that Iran needs to make a nuclear deal now, ironically, those are probably more worrying in terms of assessment of where the US is heading, because it's not a realistic prospect to get back into talks. Iran has been willing to sit down and talk for some time. And the idea that the US would enter into those nuclear negotiations and end up relieving sanctions on the regime just when it's looking so threatened doesn't seem very realistic. So maybe this is a bit more of a pretext. This is being built up to give a last chance to Iran to ask you to do something before taking military action. So
Trump wants a deal, you think, Rob, that he's using this as a threat that he doesn't really want to actually have to act on. He's hoping to get some sort of agreement.
I think he'd like some sort of agreement, but I think he's probably realistic about the fact that it's not going to happen in the short order. So it's difficult to know what he expects Iran to do in response to that recent messaging from him. I think it may just as much be a pretext to take military action by saying we gave them the chance to do a deal.
How seriously do you think Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranian regime will be taking the threats of further, and it is further because, of course, we had those strikes last year, further military action by the US?
I think they'll be taking it very seriously. I think they'll probably expect it's going to happen. I think a lot of people are expecting it's going to happen. It's quite hard to see how the US puts this build up into the Middle East in such a major and such a public way, with all the messaging that's gone around it, and then doesn't do something. I don't know what will happen, and I don't pretend to know what will happen, but I do think that if President Trump feels he's looking weak or indecisive, or that he's backed down on his threats, that would possibly push him to action.
And that action, I mean, the question it strikes me is one of the key ones, Rob, is would that action simply be against the Iranian nuclear program, like we saw previously, or would it go further and involve some sort of attempt at supporting regime change?
Well, I think there's three main choices if there were to be military action. There's action against the nuclear program, or perhaps more importantly now, the ballistic missile program, which would be a continuation, as you say, of what happened last June. There's action against the security or the organs of the state that have been conducting the repression, which would be most in line with the threats that the president has made. So the IRGC, the Basij militia, perhaps the judiciary, and that would be linked to the protests. Or there's leadership targets, which, as you're suggesting, I think would be perhaps in the hope more of engineering some sort of regime change or regime overthrow.
Rob, just briefly, finally, I'm fascinated by your own experience. I mean, obviously, the relationship between our country and Iran is pretty hostile. You were there as our ambassador for 3 years. What was it like doing that role?
Well, it was it became very tense at times. I think, you know, if you go into that job as a British diplomat, you go in with your eyes open. You know that it's a difficult relationship, but an extremely important country, a potential for a great deal of damage and destabilization. And as a diplomat, that's part of what you're trying to achieve in that posting. But of course, you have other issues like British nationals in detention and regional security. So there's a pretty full agenda. But it's not an easy regime to work with. And I think it's got harder and harder for my successors in that job.
What goes through your head when you're called into an office somewhere and you're told, right, you've got a new posting and it's Tehran?
Oh, well, I asked for it.
So. You asked for it?
Yeah.
Why, man?
It's an absolutely fascinating country. It's incredibly important geopolitically. And it's actually also it's an incredibly appealing country to live in. Yes, I mean, the people
I've heard very, very good things about the country itself. Just a shame about the people in charge. Thank you very much indeed, Rob. Fascinating conversation. Rob McCare, former British ambassador to Iran between 2018 and 2021. Listening to that was Mitchell B. Rees, a US diplomat who's worked for five US administrations, including at the White House and the State Department. Now, a distinguished fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Mitchell, always a pleasure to have you back on the programme. Rob there was saying, you know, Trump will not want to look weak here. And the fact that there is already a kind of growing US military presence in the region makes some sort of military action more likely than not. Do you agree?
I do. I think that it is likely that the president will authorize some type of military package to be used against Iran. He has probably, in the past, presidents would receive a whole variety of spectrum of escalation in military packages, and you could choose among them. The issue really is the day after. This administration has had difficulty connecting means with ends. And so it's unclear exactly what the president wants to accomplish by striking the Iranians again. He can set back their nuclear program again. He can go after their ballistic missiles. You haven't heard him talk recently about support for the protesters, though. And that was his rhetoric about a week to 10 days ago, where he was defending them and calling on them to protest, and he was going to have their back. And that's not what you're hearing now. And so, to me, it's a little muddled what the message is, and it's unclear what they're going to do and for what reason.
Well, let's just touch on that. It's a similar question to Rob's, but is this going to be about neutering Iran's nuclear program and a nuclear sort of potential, Mitchell? Or do you think Donald Trump is really serious about being the US president who toppled Maduro in Venezuela and wants to topple the Ayatollahs in Tehran?
Well, I think that he would like to do further damage to their nuclear program, although he did declare that it was obliterated in the past. So, you know, there is that.
It was disconnect. Obliterated last year, but now he's going back to obliterating.
Exactly. Yes. The ballistic missiles, as the ambassador said, clearly are an ongoing threat. And the third thing that they've messaged to the regime is that they'd like to stop their support for insurrections in the region against American friends and allies, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. So those are things that are going to take diplomacy, they're going to take negotiation, and they're going to take time. And so if the Iranians said, sure, we'll sit down and talk with you, then what is the president going to do? They've accepted his terms, but it's not going to play out for many, many months to come. That would be a real dilemma, I think, for the administration right now.
The prospect of further, you know, missile strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities, obviously sort of complicated, complex, but in some ways militarily fairly straightforward. The prospect of trying to completely bring down the Iranian regime, far, far more challenging and difficult. Does the US actually have the capacity and the capabilities to topple the Iranian government, Mitchell?
I don't think we do. I think we've learned that hard lesson in Iraq. And this is a country of 90 million people, incredibly complex, as the ambassador stated. And again, we're not going to put boots on the ground. The president has been willing, some would say even eager, to use military force, but it's usually been very specific, very targeted, and very short, very brief, with no boots on the ground, not in Venezuela, not in Syria, not in Iraq, not in Iran. So I think this is something that he has no stomach for. And that's a good thing, because I can't imagine the United States again intervening in a country that is significantly larger than Iraq and trying to engineer an outcome. This has to be left to the Iranian people. We should support them as much as we can, in any way we can. But it's going to be up to them to seize their own future.
And just finally, the response from the Iranian regime, that their armed forces have their finger on the trigger, as the regime put it, and will respond immediately and powerfully. If there were further US strikes on Iran, what might an Iranian response look like, and how concerning might that be?
Well, two things. One is, we already have reports of IRGC commanders going underground so they can't be targeted. Like the generals and the nuclear scientists were before, they are frightened. They are scared, and they should be, given how penetrated their society has been by U.S. and other intelligence agencies. The other thing is that they targeted Qatar after we struck them before, and it was given advance notice to the U.S. and to the Qataris that it was coming. It was performative. It was theatrical. It was a way for them to save some face. They're not going to do anything while this armada is in the region that is going to be provocative and escalatory, in my view.
Thank you for coming on the program. Mitchell B. Rees, diplomat who's worked for five U.S. administrations, including at the White House and State Department, a former national security advisor to Mitt Romney, and now a distinguished fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Over to you. Should Donald Trump take military action, would you like to see the US once again launching missiles, potentially going even further, at Iran? And if it does, a decision for Keir Starmer. What should Britain do? Do we support the US in that endeavour, potentially alongside Israel, or do we steer well clear and stay out of it? 0345 6060 973. Would love to hear from you this hour as well. If you are Iranian, you're Persian, you've got family in that country. Every single Iranian that I know in Britain wants the regime to fall. But would you like to see Donald Trump taking military action to try to support that end? Or could it do more harm than good? 0345 6060 973 for your thoughts on all of that. Your call's to come right after this.
This is LBC.
A Thameslink train is a place where you can just switch off. where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields, or simply relax with a podcast, playlist, or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Across the country, thousands of drivers are feeling electric about switching to an EV, and here's why. They can go from London to Sheffield on a single charge that could cost around a fiver. They're ecstatic about that and the exhilarating feeling behind the wheel. Plus, with charging made simple at home, they're always ready for the drive ahead. I can see why they're into it. Switch to an EV and get that electric feeling. Costs and range dependent on tariffs, model and driving habits. For full details, visit gov.uk/clean energy.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Idle money chills in your current account, parked in front of the telly, wanting a snack, yet too lazy to move. But thanks to Monzo, busy money got up early, automatically split your paycheck into pots, rounded up your purchases into savings, invested your interest into ISAs, oh, and has already written itself a to-do list for tomorrow. Monzo, the bank that gets your money moving. UK residents aged 18 plus, Monzo personal account required, capital at risk, T's and C's and fees may apply.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 20 past 10. Let me come straight to your call. Should the US take military action against Iran? Is that something you would like to see? And if it does happen, should we, Great Britain, support it or not? 0345 6060 973. As always, the number to call. Just like Alison's done from Westminster this evening. Alison, hi.
Good evening.
Evening, Alison.
Good evening. I am Iranian, but I lived here for nearly 40 years. But I absolutely, it's horrible to say that because you don't want other countries to attack your country. But we absolutely should support America if they are going to get rid of IRGC.
Britain should join Donald Trump. What would you like to see that alliance between us and the US doing, Alison? What sort of action would you like to see us taking?
I'm talking on behalf of lots of our friends, which tonight we had discussion about it. We want them to see them just get rid of the IRGC, the top commanders. Mm. Obviously, there's going to be some innocent people dying in between, but don't forget 30,000. Almost, this is what we think it is. We don't know exactly. But from what we can hear from people back home, nearly 30,000 and many more are being executed. So people are ready to die. Yeah, absolutely, by the regime. So people are prepared to die as long as they get rid of the regime. It's not about negotiating another mullahs coming. It's about getting this barbaric regime, IRGC, has to go.
What would it mean to you, Alison, and your, you know, as you say, your fellow Iranians living elsewhere in the world, if the regime did finally fall?
It just, hopefully, we are hoping for, nothing can be worse than what we have right now, to be honest with you. Hopefully we can have our freedom back. People can, and at the moment the only person is leading on that, as you know, is Pahlavi. Mm. And people are relying on him to come as a democracy. And for him to be educated in Western country, hopefully he has that. But at the moment, we have a leader who can lead on democracy and bring freedom back to Iran after 47 years.
But you, obviously, you're far more familiar with this than me. But is it not the case that there's no guarantee that would happen? You know, people said nobody could be worse than Saddam. People said nobody could be worse than Gaddafi in Libya. Is there a risk that if the regime does fall, then actually what comes next, as bad as obviously the IRGC is worse because the country just descends into total anarchy and civil war? Is that a risk that worries you?
I don't think so. With Pahlavi leading with it, we have lots of, we are not Iraq, we are not Gaddafi. Mm. We are not, we have much more history behind us. And we have a leader who knows, I left when I was very young, so don't think I'm supporting him one way or the other. But listening to his discussion, listening to other friends, listening to people back home, because I have lots of families back home. As you know, my name has changed because I'm scared to use my own name.
Understand.
But so, just so you know, so people, we have a leader. They didn't have a leader. Iraq didn't have anybody to replace. Gaddafi, they didn't have somebody. We have
a
leader.
Would there be a consensus around Pahlavi being the leader, or would there potentially be a split and violence and potentially civil war? Or you think there would be enough unity to make him president?
If there, listen, you don't know the most. This is the problem. When they brought Khomeini to Iran, mm-hmm. it was the same thing. France, UK, and America brought Khomeini to Iran. If you look at the history, that's the fact, because Shah didn't want to give our oil free. So they brought Khomeini, and it didn't bring that, the segregation in Iran, did it? It wasn't broken up. So they can do exactly, if Western country wants to do it, they can do exactly the same thing now. Bring Pahlavi with the same plan they did before with Khomeini. But this Pahlavi is different. He's not dictatorship. He's educated, he's a leader, and what he talks about. And people are not the same people as they were 47 years ago. They will not accept it.
Mm. And your family, Alison, your family who are still in Iran, would they be very much with you in sharing the hope that Donald Trump will launch attacks on their country?
They weren't in June when the war started that 12 days, but they are now because they lost so many. You can't believe it. It was a bloodshed. And this is my family who are a doctor back home. I haven't heard of my cousin who's a doctor. I'm worried what's happened to him.
You don't know what's happened to him.
Exactly. But I heard from friends who were even Muslim, proper Muslim, and they're still fed up with this regime because what they've done within last few weeks, it has been barbaric. So people have turned away because of what happened, because what they did to their own people. How could they do that? So therefore, they have nothing else. They have nothing to lose, basically. They lost everything. They have nothing to lose. And their only hope is Western country to help them. They chant that. Last weekend, it was over. You can get this number from Metropolis, but it was estimated 200,000 people, Iranian people, in the street, in Trafalgar Square, going to U.S. Embassy, which none of the media covered, 200,000 people chanting, Pahlavi, we want you back.
And was part of that urging the U.S. to get involved and support the protesters?
Yes, that's why we went to the embassy.
Right, I hear you. Alison, loud and clear, I hear you. And I really hope all your family, in Iran are able to stay safe and well, despite the brutal, as you say, brutal persecution and repression being meted out by the regime. Thank you, Alison. You take care of yourself. Let's talk to David in South Woodford. Alison, David says, yep, the U.S. should absolutely go for it and we should join them in doing so. Should we?
No, not at all. We just have to look at the neighbours nearby, Pakistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE and Saudi Arabia have plainly said to America, you cannot use our airspace, you cannot use our territory to launch attacks. No one wants instability in the Middle East for another country apart from Israel. So we have to look at the neighbours. No one, Iran will break up. If this goes ahead, Iran will break up.
Why do you think that, David? Alison there, who's, family there, comes from there, says, no, that's not the case. I'll tell you.
There's a separatist movement there from the Baloch people. Just look at Libya. What happened to Libya? What happened to Iraq? They were basket cases. Look at Yemen. Every country we've attacked, the Middle East, it becomes fractured. So this is what's going to happen. It's going to be a power vacuum. And this lady was talking about the Pahlavi people being peaceful. They had demonstrations outside the Iranian embassy about a week ago. 4 police officers were injured. So this is just an example of what's going to happen in Iran.
I think, yes, it got a little bit heated. I don't think, when you compare that to the violence that is being inflicted on protesters in Iran, David, Alison's point is, when an estimated 30,000 people have been killed in the last few weeks just for opposing the regime, how much worse could it really get?
Well, you look, nobody, it's a population of 90 million people. Mm-hmm. Listen, I'm no fan of the Iranian regime at all. But going around bombing when the neighbouring countries who know more about the area than we do 5,000 miles.
Most of those countries would not shed any tears whatsoever, certainly not Saudi Arabia, if the Iranian regime was toppled. Do you not think it would bring more stability to the Middle East?
No, it would instability. Look at the statements made by the Saudi royal family. They do not want the Americans using their airspace.
Yeah, they might not want them using their airspace. They might not want to be involved in it, but I think they'd secretly welcome it, wouldn't they?
No, not instability. Would you want rats to move in next door to your house? You wouldn't.
The Saudi and the Iranian rivalry, the sort of that tension, has been destabilising the Middle East for some time.
It has. But after the Israeli attack on Qatar, the Middle East woke up and realised if America cannot control Israel and attacks Qatar, where the biggest American base is, the Americans will never protect them. So they're more looking away from America. Saudi Arabia recently signed a military pact with Pakistan. Why? because they cannot trust America. The Middle East does no longer trust America to be their guarantor.
David, I mean, you're right to point out that when the West and the US and Britain has tried regime change in the Middle East in the past, including the fairly recent past, it's never ended well. I mean, that is true. Alison was saying she's confident as an Iranian that this time would be different, but you're clearly not.
No, not at all. Where has it, you give me a single example where it's ended well?
I mean, I can't, because I don't think there are any.
No,
I mean, Afghanistan ended up back in the hands of the Taliban. Iraq descended into civil war for years. I mean, there's an argument now maybe it's better than it was under Saddam. Libya, I mean, basket case was the word that you used. Syria, potentially slightly better now than it was under Assad.
Syria's broken as well. Half of it was taken by Israel. Turkey controls certain parts.
Half of Syria is not taken by Israel.
Well, a certain section, they control a certain area of it.
It's if you're talking about the Golan Heights, it's tiny.
Golan Heights. Golan Heights.
But it's nothing like Cartwright. We've got to be important. You can't.
No, of course.
You can't say Israel controls half of Syria, because that's clearly false.
Well, they control sections of it. Turkey controls other sections. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to Iraq, then, if you ask any people, take a poll of anyone over 40 who remembers before and after Saddam Hussein, close to 50% want Saddam Hussein regime back. This is what I'm saying. They've lost so much in Iraq.
It's
basically a failed state.
I hear what you're saying. And you're right to say that the US and the UK's history of trying to interfere and intervene and install better leaders than the ones that are already there in countries like Iraq and in Iran and others is never ended particularly well. That is a concern. Of course it's a concern. And you're right to point it out. David, thank you very much indeed for calling in to do so. More of your thoughts to come. Should the US bomb Iran? Should it try and back the protesters and get rid of the regime in Tehran? And if it does, should Britain support it? Plus,
they talk about a new relationship. The only thing new about this is the naivety of this government, desperate because their economy is in straits, thinking China will give them growth.
Conservative former leader Sir Ian Duncan-Smith there criticising the government as Keir Starmer heads to China. Kemi Badenoch also says the Prime Minister shouldn't be going, but Starmer says it will make the UK not just richer, but safer. So who's right? Get the very latest on that story after the news headlines at 10:31. With Darrell Jackson.
Donald Trump has warned Iran time is running out to reach a deal over its nuclear program. The US president says a massive armada is heading to the Middle East following the steady build-up of US military forces in the Gulf. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has arrived in China for a 3-day visit, the first by a British Prime Minister in 8 years. Sir Keir is seeking to strengthen trading and cultural ties between the two countries. And the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiries found physical, sexual and emotional abuse was allowed to take place for decades at Fettes College in Edinburgh. The failure to protect children from the 1950s to the 1980s has been described by the inquiry chair as shameful. LBC weather: fog lingering in central and eastern areas tomorrow, mostly cloudy with the odd bright spell in places. Some light rain in the northeast of Scotland and the southwest, a high of 10 degrees.
LBC, coming up on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
Tomorrow morning with Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, will Donald Trump go to war with Iran after declaring he sent a massive armada of US ships? Plus, a study finds that Labour will lose the next general election unless it tackles the decline of Britain's high streets. Nick will take your calls on that. And also speak with the cafe owner who has joined the pubs in barring Labour MPs from his establishment. All of that and much more coming up with Nick Ferrari at Breakfast tomorrow morning from 7 o'clock here on LBC.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. LBC.
Across the country, thousands of drivers are feeling electric about switching to an EV. And here's why. They can go from London to Sheffield on a single charge that could cost around a fiver. They're ecstatic about that and the exhilarating feeling behind the wheel. Plus, with charging made simple at home, they're always ready for the drive ahead. I can see why they're into it. Switch to an EV and get that electric feeling. Cost and range dependent on tariffs, model and driving habits. For full details, visit gov.uk/cleanenergy.
Hi Derek, Tara from Flash Designs here, hope you're well. Not sure if you've seen my emails from last month, but could you please pay my invoice? Thank you so much, bye. Hi, it's Tara, Flash Designs. Did you get my last voicemail? I know you're busy, but please pay my invoice today, if possible. Hello, again, it's Tara, again, politely nudging, again.
Still chasing unpaid invoices? Let Sage Copilot help do the chasing so you can get paid up to 7 days faster. Search Sage Accountant today.
Attention dogs, this is not a drill. If your dinner comes in dodgy brown balls or smells suspicious, at best, you deserve to know this. Butternut Box makes fresh dog food with ingredients you'd find in your human's fridge. In fact, some humans have even tasted it. For quality control, obviously. Anyway, let's hope your human was listening. Butternut Box. Fresh food. Happy dogs. Try Butternut Box today and get 25% off your first two boxes. Offer available online in the UK and Ireland to first-time customers only.
There's so much more to enjoy when you fly in Emirates Economy. Spacious legroom, delicious regionally inspired meals, complimentary drinks, and with the latest movies, TV shows, music and live sport, some of the best entertainment in the skies. And our family services make your journey simple and fun. Plan your next trip and start the holiday early in Emirates Economy. Fly Emirates, fly better.
This is LBC. Message Ben Kentish on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
10:35, very different perspectives from Sam in Bristol and Morgan. Morgan first. Ben, when will the West learn its lesson? Imposing regime change from the outside always backfires and only strengthens the regime, as they can point to foreign influence in order to delegitimise the genuine protest. That's a fair point, Morgan. The regime has already suggested that the protests are being backed by sort of interfering foreigners. That argument gets stronger if that actually proves to be the case. Sam in Bristol, though, says, Ben, these people don't know their history. Iran is totally incomparable to countries like Iran, Syria and Libya. Iran has a rich history and proud culture going back thousands of years. The people there deserve so much better than this Islamist government. And the people saying Israel wants to destabilize the Middle East are quite frankly thick. The people of Iran and Israel, Sam says, have a deep history that's entwined biblically. Sam, I think, advocating there for some sort of military action against Iran. Let's talk to Sarah in Hampstead about it all. Sarah, do you think the US should do it and do you think Britain should join it? Evening.
Hi, Ben. No, my view is absolutely not. I think it's really desperate that we Iranians in the diaspora are sat here in the comfort of our relative safety in London or the US. And are asking for our country, our motherland, to be bombed with our families in it. It's absolutely not something that I think we should be advocating for. And I just can't see in any good conscience that I can sit here in the peace of Hampstead and say, yes, bomb that country.
And you've got family still there as well, Sarah, like Alison.
I do. My very closest family, my grandmother, my aunties, my cousins, all of them desperate to see this regime gone. And, you know, I'll be honest, none of us have the answer. You know, you think maybe Trump could do something, maybe he could get rid of them. But as you say, the question is what comes next? Even Trump has said he hasn't endorsed this Pahlavi. Mm. He's said it should be someone from inside Iran. And it should be, if you look at what he did in Venezuela, it's likely going to be someone within the regime because he wants stability, because he wants to be able to go there and do business. And yes, he's not going to countenance any further regional instability, which will come if there's any sort of transition to something which is something like what people actually want, which is a democratic government.
When Alison was saying that people in Iran, Sarah, are now of the view, from the ones that she's speaking to at least, that actually even war, even military action by the US would be less of a threat to them than the ongoing brutality of the regime. It sounds like you've got a slightly different perspective on that.
Look, there's just no right or wrong answer. There's no black and white here. It's a lot of grey. There is nothing that says this brutality from a Western state would be better than a brutality from the Iranian regime. Trump's already talked about a lot of violence. Why can we not read between the lines here as to what could potentially
happen? I mean, that would be directed at, presumably, and you're right, we don't know, but the presumption has to be that would be directed at the Iranian nuclear facilities, at military infrastructure, and perhaps even the Iranian leaders. But your worry is obviously the potential for it to impact civilians as well.
I mean, this is the president of a country whose own infrastructure, the ICE, are killing their own citizens in America. And we see what kind of vitriol he has for his own citizens. So I don't understand the basis on which we might say, oh, he's of course going to do as much as he can to minimize any casualties in Iran. That didn't happen in the 12-day war as much as they like to claim it. And if any other experiences have shown us, you know, these will just be anyone killed in Iran, civilians, they will just be called, you know, casualties.
But the point, obviously, I don't mean to say this, Sarah, but Alison's point was, well, 30,000 civilians have been killed, according to some estimates, by the regime in the last few weeks alone. So could it be worse?
Yes. Yes, of course it could be worse. Are we really saying that potential strikes between a US, Western, Israeli coalition are going to be so precise that that they won't...
unlikely to kill 30,000 people, surely.
As I say, I mean, I think you make a good point. You know, this, as I say, I just don't think this is as black and white as we like to think.
It's the law of unintended consequences, isn't it?
And it's all... Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. And no, it's also what comes next. You know, nobody's thought, my parents were those who were fooled by this regime in by the Islamic Revolution then, and they were out on the streets protesting because they thought Khomeini was going to bring them something better than the Shah. They tell me stories of how they used to protest, and they said we were completely fooled. We did not know what we were getting ourselves into. Who, you know, we should know our history, and we should know that anyone that's going to be imposed on Iran by anyone who's in exile or living somewhere else or bought in by any other Western government is not going to bode well for us.
Sarah, I hear you. You know, it's a very, very fair point that we simply don't know that what comes next won't be worse than what's there, as appalling as the current situation is. Thank you, Sarah. And again, hope your family in Iran are able to stay as safe as is possible in that country at the moment. It is 10:41 here on LBC. More to come on Iran in a couple of minutes' time. Let's talk China first for a few minutes, where Keir Starmer has landed ahead of a several-day visit to that country in a storm of controversy. Kemi Badenoch coming out today and saying the Prime Minister should not be going to China, a country that is a threat to our national security. I mean, clearly is. The Prime Minister and his team have taken burner phones, such is the risk of their normal phones being hacked and tapped into by the Chinese authorities. So it's clearly a risk. Given that, given it is a foe, in a way, of ours from a security perspective, should the Prime Minister be going there, shaking hands and trying to cosy up to its leaders? Jaya Pathak, as External Relations at the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. Jaya, good to have you on the programme this evening. Should Keir Starmer be in China?
I think it's, very much the view of those of us who are watching the China from the China watching space and those in foreign policy and those in the human rights background to really feel as though this visit and this trip to China is very difficult to stomach on the backdrop of various things. First and foremost, British parliamentarians who remain sanctioned by the Chinese state unjustly. We have a elderly British citizen, Jimmy Lai, languishing behind bars in Hong Kong for no other reason than standing up for democracy. We have Hong Kongers who have fled to the UK, who have bounties on their head. We have other diaspora groups, Chinese dissidents, who are being transnationally repressed by the Chinese state, and yet the government have just approved a Chinese mega embassy. And then we add in all the national security risks around cybersecurity, cyber attacks, espionage, and all of that. So really, in light of all of those decisions, it's obvious that the government have decided to make a trip to China to try and pursue their mission of further economic growth, almost looking to the Chinese state as an economic lifeline, which is what tends to be the case, not only with this government, but previous governments of all political affiliations as well.
You think they're putting kind of economic security ahead of national security?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very clear. I think that the trade-off here isn't whether, you know, the Prime Minister should be flying around and meeting heads of state, even of countries with which we have a fairly hostile relationship with. That it's very important that the Prime Minister does attend these types of visits and bilaterals around the world, because the world's in a very precarious place. Really, what we're talking about here is that the engagement we have with China should not just be defined around economic growth, but actually it needs to be defined around the threat that China poses to UK interests and values first and foremost, for a number of reasons. One that I just want to harrow in on for your listeners is there is this mirage around economic growth when it comes to this Chinese state, and almost this obsession that all of our promises and all the optimism we have regarding our economy and economic security is going to come from the Chinese state, which is not the case at all. The Chinese economy is underperforming. It has underperformed in the past decade. And as it's underperforming, the Chinese economy becomes more reliant on exports. And so whilst the Chinese do rely in some way on the UK market, yeah, there's very little that the UK has that China wants. So we've got an imbalanced relationship. It's a very poor deal all around.
Right. And so even if there is some credibility in the argument that maybe it could make us richer, Keir Starmer saying today, Jaya, that it will also make us safer, him going to China. Your response to that?
You know, it's very hard to try and find a route out of this other than, you know, those are all the right things to say because they understand that they've got to go to China and show face and all of this stuff. I mean, the Chinese state of recent years and the current Chinese government have not kept to any promises, have not kept to any obligations, and in fact, just continue conducting business as they wish to do. And if we are going to be honest about it, you know, we have opposition within the Labour Party on this and also from ministers in the government who are on our side, who agree that these are concerns. It's very difficult to bypass those national security risks as well as the risks that we have regarding British industry, British sectors, British workers who are being let down, who will never be able to outcompete with Chinese state-subsidised programmes, which often rely on forced labour and produce cheap imports. So you've got two folds of this argument, and really it's key to understand here that this, you know, government and other UK governments have decided to pursue a tighter relationship for economic reasons. However, we know with the facts that actually the trend is proving the other way. And so our relationship needs to be a balanced one that first and foremost puts the UK's interests at the heart and not that of the Chinese states.
Jaya, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. Jaya Pathak is External Relations at the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. Let me know your thoughts on that. I kind of get why Keir Starmer sort of makes the argument that, you know, it's better to deal face to face and have a relationship with these countries like China than just boycott them and let that kind of potential enmity develop even further. But Jaya makes point, you know, is this really serving Britain's interests? Should Keir Starmer be in China, or is Kemi Bade not right to say, no, this is not the right message to be sending by the Prime Minister? 0345 606 0973 for your calls and your WhatsApps. It's 84850 on the text, plus more of your calls to come on Iran in a moment, and a first look at tomorrow's newspaper front pages. Ben Ketchish here, and this is LBC.
On the latest episode of The News Agents.
What does Kemi Badenoch mean when she's telling centrists to get out of her way? Are they not welcome in her Conservative Party? And what on earth is Trump's armada doing off the coast of Iran?
Get the latest episode of The News Agents with Emily Maitlis, John Sopel and Lewis Goodall. Listen or watch on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Hiya, Kenny the Hamster here, beloved pet of Doug and Carol Brookbank. Now, I've got to hand it to Doug and Kazza. They're doing school pickups, jobs, trips to the supermarket, and still find time to get healthy. Apparently, it's down to some NHS Healthy Choices quiz. Only took them 5 minutes to do, then gave them a simple plan to get started.
Come on, kids.
Total amazeballs.
Take your first little step to healthy. Search NHS Healthy Choices quiz to get a score and a plan that's right for you.
Unfold a world of on-the-go entertainment with the Samsung Galaxy Z Fold 7. The massive 8-inch main screen means you'll see the bigger picture as every exciting moment unfolds. Share every highlight and keep the whole family entertained wherever you go. Buy yours now and claim £300 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat, and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues, with our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern.
Selling your car can be super simple if you choose We Buy Any Car instead of a confusing part exchange. Because with We Buy Any Car, you'll have cash in the bank for more bargaining power on your next car. If only they could make getting to that countryside wedding simpler.
Make a U-turn. Make a U-turn.
Oh, no. We Buy Any Car. Selling made simple. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison. And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done, you should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job, done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Text 84850.
10 to 11 the time. Talk to Frank, who's a new caller, about Iran in a couple of minutes time. Let's have a quick look at what's dominating tomorrow's newspaper front pages, first of all, though. Starting with The Times, which reports that Keir Starmer has ditched a new plan to overhaul disability benefits. Prime Minister has apparently vetoed attempts to reform the welfare system with Number 10, trying to avoid another confrontation with Labour MPs. The Daily Telegraph also leading on Starmer. They've got a story about how the Prime Minister once advocated using the European Convention on Human Rights to investigate British troops over their actions in Iran. This was back in 2000. Oh, talking about scraping the barrel. 2008, Keir Starmer apparently once advocated using human rights laws, EU human rights laws, to investigate British troops. The Guardian leads on the story we're discussing this hour. Time is running out, Trump says, as US armada heads towards Iran. It's the same on the front page of the Mirror. Trump's war threat to Iran. And the Daily Mail, too. Clamped down to conflagration. Trump says my armada is ready to strike with speed and violence. Iran responds, our forces have fingers on triggers and we will respond like never before. And last but not least, the Daily Express once again leading with Kemi Badenoch. Kemi Badenoch sneezes these days and it's straight on the front of the Daily Express. Kemi Badenoch, my party is for serious people and not for drama queens. Front page news, according to the Daily Express. Right, 10:51 is the time. We are talking about whether or not Donald Trump should launch military action against Iran, and if he does, whether you think Britain should join in with it. And Frank's calling from the very first time from Westminster tonight to talk about exactly that. Welcome, Frank.
Good evening to you and all your listeners. First time caller.
Evening,
Frank. I 100% think they should win. I'm an Iranian myself. I fully support any action and any help we can get. I have close family. My cousin, my own cousin, he was killed in the last uprising, in the recent one, with total brutality.
In the last few weeks, Frank?
In the last few weeks, my own cousin, yes, it's very sad. And the way I found that, I actually was going to every night up to 4 a.m. The only news you could get is through your social media. Mm. And popped her image. She passed away. I called Canada, I called U.S. Is that true? Has she really passed away? Yes, she has passed away.
I'm so sorry, Frank. Do you know what happened to her?
It's brutal. I know. It's images are there, very similar to many others. Army level missiles and bullets. She was killed by one of those. Really,
it's horrific. What the Iranians.
It is horrific. And I'm not the only one. We have lost relatives. There are quite a few people, which they've actually. This is quite a common. You talk to anyone, and it's the number of... We don't know how many there are. They don't know how many people they have passed away. But the key is that this regime, they have been in power for the last 47 years with total brutality, mismanagement of economy. They don't really care about the people. They have their own agenda. From day one, they had an agenda against... West.
Yes.
They started with slogans of death to America, death to Israel.
Can we in the West, Frank, as the UK, as the US, do we really have the kind of capability to change the regime and change the government in Iran? But I don't know how, short of putting boots on the ground like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We don't want that. And the time has passed on. The 12 days war which Israel operated there, they took something like 40 of the top, for sure they took the top 12 out, and there were like 40 or 50 other...
But they just replaced them, don't they? You can assassinate the top commanders and generals and the Ayatollahs, but they just regrow.
Their government is at the weakest. They no longer have the support of the ordinary people out on the street.
Action now might succeed in a way that perhaps it wouldn't have done a few years.
They are an average family, and I'm talking about average family now. Half of the salary, they can buy bread and 12 eggs. That's really as bad as it is. People have, you're talking about empty fridge symptoms now.
Yeah. I hear you, and I get the point. How much worse could it really be than what the people of Iran are living through now? Frank, thank you very much. Lots of Iranians get in touch. The vast majority, I must say, disagreeing with Sarah and saying, look, please help us. Come to the support and the aid of our friends and family and do something. Will Donald Trump do it? Should he? Frank, great first call. I hope we speak again very, very soon. And I'm really sorry once again about the awful, awful murder of your cousin. Frank in Westminster. Dan's on the line down the road in Newham tonight. Hi, Dan.
Hey, yeah. Thanks for taking the call. To be honest, I can't believe that we're talking about going to war with Iran. It's, in my eyes, insane. And not only because of the immoral reason of going in and killing people, which the West has a terrible history of doing. I don't think the US is obviously not interested in creating a democratic Iran or any good vision for Iran. They want to destabilize it and for it to become basically a country in ruins that eventually will be taken over by Israel and the United States.
What's your basis for that? What's your basis for saying that? It sounds a bit conspiratorial, if I may say so, because, you know, on the one hand, we've got Iranian saying, please, please do something. And your view is, well, sorry, but tell them it's tough. They should just carry on living under one of the most repressive regimes on the face of the earth.
OK, well, let's talk about it. Every major war the UK and the US has been involved in starts with a huge propaganda campaign, right? We think about the weapons of mass destruction. Talk about
propaganda here.
Well, I think it's about this. We're hearing every day 30,000 deaths, 40,000 deaths. It's not backed by
You just heard Frank talk about his cousin being brutally murdered by the Iranian regime.
It could be, but I'll be honest, right? Anyone can ring in and pretend anything.
Have a look. Me Frank's making it up.
There's a lot of Mossad and CIA.
This is nonsense. It's always Israel, isn't it? It all comes back to Israel. Mossad, Frank's from Mossad, and he's called in to make up a story about that's so offensive, Dan. We'll leave that there. You're not going to call in and tell me the previous caller who's told us that his cousin's just been brutally murdered is making it up or is what, an Israeli stooge or some nonsense. We'll leave that there. Mary's calling in summary to finish up the conversation. Mary, just respond to Dan, if you would, because I don't have the patience to do it, quite frankly. He's saying, look, how do we believe this 30,000 figure? Maybe it's not all as bad as we're being told. Your response.
I can't believe that Dan says something like that. I am terribly, terribly upset about people making a comment. They don't know nothing about Iran. I wish they could see truly from Iranian eyes what that regime does to people, what this regime are capable of doing.
Dan reckons it's all, and you are Iranian, Mira.
Of course, Dan
thinks it's Western propaganda.
I am proud Iranian. We, our leader, which is Crown Prince, people are shouting in the streets, fighting for his name and shouted. I'm sure you and LBC, because they are near the area, you have seen the demonstration. You have to seen that 3-4 weeks now, everybody's shouting for his name. He has been fighting 46 years of this.
I'm so sorry, Mary. We're really out of time, but you would like to see America get involved, would you?
Definitely.
And Britain?
100%. Britain, America, France, whoever can help Iranian people, please do that.
Thank you, Mary. I'm sorry we didn't have longer, but I really, really appreciate the call. I think something's got to be done. Military action? I don't know. We're going to move on and talk after the news about next summer's World Cup.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, Donald Trump has warned Iran's time is running out to agree a nuclear deal as a US Navy armada makes its way towards the Gulf. The US president says it will be ready to act with speed and violence if talks fail. Tehran says it stands ready for talks, but if pushed, it would defend itself and respond like never before. Rob McCary, former British ambassador to Iran, told LBC there are three main choices if the US goes for military action.
There's action against the nuclear program, or perhaps more importantly now, the ballistic missile program. There's action against the security or the organs of the state that have been conducting the repression, and that would be linked to the protests. Or there's leadership targets, which would be perhaps in the hope more of engineering some sort of regime change or regime overthrow.
Sir Keir Starmer says he's absolutely focused on national interests as he begins his visit to China. It's the first time a prime minister has travelled to Beijing in 8 years. The Tory leader Kemi Badenoch promised Conservative members she will lead a party of serious people, not drama queens. In a wide-ranging speech, she criticised what she called the psychodrama of both Reform UK and Labour. Sir Nick Clegg's told LBC it's worth considering an overhaul of the student loan system to tackle levels of debt. There are concerns that graduates' debt interest is spiralling. Sir Nick says the system is completely different now to the one introduced when he was Deputy Prime Minister in 2012.
The situation is very different. The labour market is much tougher than it's been in recent years for graduates. So I think it is definitely worth thinking of a real overhaul now. This doesn't seem to be... the governments just seem to be tinkering rather than looking in the round about how to make university finances sustainable and make it fairer for graduates.
Well, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told us the student loans system is fair. And more than 1,100 jobs are at risk after the original factory shop fell into administration. All of its 137 stores, which sell clothing and homeware at a discount, could close. LBC weather, fog lingering in central and eastern areas tomorrow, mostly cloudy with the odd bright spell in places. Some light rain in northeast Scotland and the southwest, a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ben Kentish.
After 11 is the time. You're listening to Ben Kentish here on LBC. A very, very good evening, and I hope you're very well if you're just tuning in and joining me on the programme. There are few joys greater, are there not, than an English World Cup summer. The sun beating down, the beer gardens packed, the hope, the anticipation, the daring to dream. Could it finally be our year? Is it finally coming home? I love it. I actually love it. I cannot wait for next summer's World Cup. I've been lucky enough to follow England to two World Cups in the past. I would love to go to the one, it's not even next year, this year. This year! My goodness, it's 2026. I would love to go later this year. Not sure. It's totally conducive to having a newborn baby, but that's a conversation to be had with the wife at some point. But I'm already so excited for the World Cup this summer. A new manager, a new generation of players coming through. Perhaps, just once. Finally, football is coming home. And yet, kind of tempering that excitement and dampening some of the jubilation that I think is to come. as the World Cup gets closer, is a kind of growing campaign for some sort of political statement to be made ahead of the World Cup, which of course takes place in North America, predominantly in the US, but also in Canada and Mexico. Off the back of what is going on in the United States of America, the crackdown on migrants by Donald Trump, the shooting in cold blood, as many people see it, of innocent protesters, the attack and the undermining of US democracy and so on, has prompted some people to say, firstly, that England should be boycotting the World Cup and Scotland and the other nations, and not taking part in the competition. I think that is utterly, utterly ridiculous. But some people aren't going quite that far, but they are proposing that England fans shouldn't head across the Atlantic and follow their team because of security concerns, because of the kind of potential for outbreaks of violence in the US and what we've seen in Minneapolis and the kind of the feeling that that country right now is a bit of a tinderbox just waiting to be set alight. And those calls have been given backing today by none other than former FIFA president Sepp Blatter, a slightly discredited figure, admittedly, given his history of corruption charges. But he has backed calls today for England fans to boycott the World Cup in the United States. It comes after another guy called Mark Pief, a Swiss anti-corruption lawyer who's worked with FIFA in the past, suggested that fans might like to stay away from the United States in order to send a point and send a message about Donald Trump. Sepp Blatter writing on social media today, "I think Mark Pief is right to question this World Cup." What Pief said is this: "What we are seeing domestically, the marginalisation of political opponents, abuses by immigration services, etc., hardly encourages fans to go there. For fans who do go, just one piece of advice, avoid the United States. You'll get a better view on television anyway." And Sepp Blatter has come out and says that's absolutely right. However much you might want to follow your team, however excited you are about the World Cup, don't go, stay at home and watch it on TV. Others, as I say, have gone further. They don't think we should be competing at all because it's a vindication of Donald Trump, his administration. It's further kind of prestige for him at a time when actually we should be turning our backs on the US president and what he's doing. I think what a load of complete and utter garbage. Football is football. Politics is politics. Yes, sometimes they interact. Yes, sometimes they intersect, but they should be kept as separate as possible. I, for one, cannot wait for the World Cup. If I could go, I would love to. If you are going, you're thinking about it, good on you. Have the best time possible. Don't boycott it. Don't cut off your nose to spite your face. The idea that Donald Trump is going to care one jot if some England fans don't go, let's be honest, the idea he'd care at all if England pulled out completely is a nonsense, if you ask me. Just focus on the football, for goodness sake. Yeah, it's tough times people are living through at the moment. The world's a difficult place right now. Do we have to suck every hit of joy out of everything just because some sort of do-gooders, tokenistic virtue signalers want to send a message to Donald Trump? It's ridiculous, isn't it? Or is it? Or do you think, actually, given what we're seeing in the United States, and bear in mind that only 2 days ago I said that I think there is now a very strong case that the word fascism and fascist is arguably applicable to what we're seeing in America, do you think in that context that we should perhaps be sending more of a message? That fans should be boycotting it, given what Trump is doing to his own people in the US. Should we be pulling out the home nations, those that are qualified, of participating in that World Cup? Or are you with me? Let the football be the football and let the politics be the politics and keep them separate. Because if you start taking a stand about the Football World Cup, my goodness, you just end up kind of making everything into a tokenistic gesture, don't you? What do you think? Sepp Blatter suggesting fans should boycott the World Cup in opposition to Donald Trump. Does the bloke have a point, or is this a load of complete and utter baloney? You can call or WhatsApp that number, 0345 6060 973. This is Philip. This is the most offensive thing that someone said to me in a very, very long time. This comes in on WhatsApp. "I bet you're a Spurs fan, Ben. It's always supporters from smaller clubs who follow the national side." I'm not a Spurs fan, Philip. I don't support a small club like Spurs. I support Barnet. Thank you for the WhatsApp. Let's talk to David Bernstein about it all. Former chairman of the Football Association between 2010 and 2013. Former chairman of Manchester City 1998 to 2003. And a former chairman as well of Wembley Stadium. Lots of chairs. David, great to have you with us on the programme. Straight to the point, is Sepp Blatter right?
I don't think so, no. I knew Sepp Blatter pretty well when I was at the FA. I dealt with him quite a bit. But I think one's got to say with Sepp Blatter now, I wouldn't take what he says too seriously. I think his credibility is pretty short. And, you know, he took FIFA into a position where they were really in disrepute. So I wouldn't rate his opinions too highly. And additionally, you know, when you go back over the years and you see where the World Cup has been played in Russia, with all its issues, with the in certain Middle Eastern countries, with terrible human rights issues, and even in South America, won't name any countries in particular, but one or two who have got very poor records. So, you know, I'd be a lot safer, a lot happier in the USA than I would in some of those countries.
Even if we don't, you know, pull out, as some sort of a small minority of people seem to think that we should do as a country, the idea that fans might like to stay away, that fans might not like to give it their kind of, you know, their attention, their focus, their money in protest at Donald Trump. Do you sort of understand those calls, David, or are you, well, are you against that as well?
Every person's entitled to their own views, and if certain fans feel very strongly on certain issues, then of course they should stay away. I mean, it's really up to them and, you know, how they feel about things. But in general, you know, in my view, the USA remains a great country with a lot of problems, and I'm not underestimating the issues they've got. But all in all, still a great country. I actually went to the last World Cup in the USA. I went to matches in New York and Chicago, and it was absolutely wonderful. And I don't doubt they will stage, with Canada and Mexico, of course, it's not just the USA.
True.
They will stage a great World Cup. So everybody must make up their own minds. And if they feel strongly about certain things, strongly enough not to go, then good luck to them. But in overall, I would be personally very happy to go there.
If it was a country, and you've touched on it that it has been in the past, but if it was a country with a far more egregious record on human rights even than Donald Trump's America, David, if the next World Cup was awarded to, or the one after was awarded to, I don't know, Vladimir Putin, Russia, against, hypothetically speaking, or, you know, or China, you know, some people might point to, do you think there's a stronger case then, or is your view a kind of more principled one that actually sport and politics should be kept separate?
I think on the whole, they should be kept separate because, you know, no one's perfect, no country's perfect. I mean, you mentioned China, where our Prime Minister is visiting at the moment.
Very true, yes. You know, and they had the Olympics, of course.
If it's good enough for him, then it should be good enough, you know, to hold a World Cup affair. And if they held it, I'd be perfectly happy to go there as well, in spite of their imperfections. And it doesn't mean for a moment I approve of everything that they do. Now, if you said to me, should we have a World Cup in Iran? I would say most definitely not, because I think they've crossed, you know, the Rubicon in the sense of what they've been doing, what's happened there,
right,
the massacre of thousands of people and so on. I think it's a rather different situation. That's a real extreme.
Yes, but to be fair, China's accused of genocide against the Uyghur people. So human rights, then there's a strong case, isn't there, that people should boycott, you know, sporting events there?
Well, there is. But, you know, you can put up, for different reasons, you put up a pretty strong case for two-thirds of the world, probably, not to go to, for different reasons. And I think, by and large, if sport's going to thrive internationally, one's got to, you'd probably use the argument that sport tends to be a very civilizing influence on these things. If anything, it is a force for good. And, and holding international sporting events does put some positive pressures, I think, on these countries to sort of behave a little better. So,
okay,
you know, in general, I think these, if we're going to have world sport, then these events have to go ahead.
The suggestion from Sepp Blatter, echoing a man whom people might not be familiar with, Mark Pierce, who worked with FIFA and is a anti-corruption lawyer, that actually sort of fans who do go to the US might not be safe. He says, upon arrival, fans should expect if they don't behave properly with the authorities, they will be immediately sent home if they are lucky. I mean, can we be confident that England fans travelling to the US will be safe?
Well, I think probably safer than if you didn't behave in Russia or if you didn't behave in certain Middle Eastern countries. I think America is still a great democracy. I mean, it's got plenty of problems, and I'm not for 1 minute underestimating them. But it's a great democracy. I'd feel perfectly safe in the USA if I behave reasonably. I mean, if anybody who behaves unreasonably, you can't say what would happen. That's always been the case. So I wouldn't, if you're going there to enjoy the football and not to misbehave, then I think you'd be perfectly safe and probably have a great time.
David, can I ask you about sort of FIFA more broadly, who obviously organised the World Cup, and particularly their president Gianni Infantino, who's become a bit of a sort of poster boy, fanboy of Donald Trump, you know, regularly sort of pictured alongside him.
Yes,
obviously, FIFA awarded Trump the sort of FIFA Peace Prize. Is there a sort of worry there about not so much the World Cup, but FIFA as an organisation, you know, sort of legitimising and cosying up to a very controversial US president who is accused of undermining American democracy?
Well, I think there is to some extent. I mean, I knew Infantino pretty well when he was at UEFA, and I was at the FA.
What did you make of him?
Well, he was very capable. I mean, he was a serious player. I never quite imagined he'd become president of FIFA as he has done. And if you're asking for sort of a feel, I think he has cozied up rather over much to Trump and. Mm. As many other people have done. I mean, Trump has got this way about him, hasn't he? Look how our own prime minister cozied up to him in the Oval Office, pulling out invitations for state visits and so on. I didn't find that very very inspiring. And a lot of other very powerful people have cozied up to him as well. Even at Davos, you had half the world's business leaders cozying up to him and. It's very, 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 very difficult. And I've learned from experience, unless you're on the inside with these things and understand the nuances and the power plays and so on, it's a bit difficult in reality to judge. Just like when people ask me about so-and-so football club, and my general answer is every club is different. So unless you're on the inside, it's very difficult to know what the dynamic is and what's going on.
I was just thinking back to the last World Cup, though, when FIFA banned England players from wearing the rainbow armband because it was a political gesture. And then you fast forward, 3 years or so, and now you've got that same organisation awarding Donald Trump its own sort of inaugural peace prize and the president, praising him in the Oval Office. I mean, FIFA's supposed to be a sort of non-partisan, non-political organisation. And I'd put it to you, Dave, they're not doing a very good job of that at the moment.
No, I agree absolutely. I thought the awarding of the Peace Prize was a bit ridiculous. It's a bit like that poor lady giving her Nobel Peace Prize to Trump. I mean, I couldn't believe that. Nor can I believe he even accepted it. I mean, what a strange thing to do. He's a very strange man with a very big ego.
Yeah, well, that is absolutely undeniable. Thank you very much, David Bernstein, former chairman of the Football Association, former chairman of Manchester City, and a former chairman as well of Wembley Stadium. What do you think? Should we boycott the World Cup, whether it's the team or the fans? Is what Donald Trump is doing in the US so egregious that we shouldn't reward it by taking part in any sort of sporting contest in that country whatsoever? Or fans shouldn't be spending their money to go and watch because of Trump? No, sorry, I'm not on board with it. Maybe you are. Maybe you're with me. 0345 60 60 973. What do you make of calls for England, and I presume this applies to Scotland as well, given they've qualified too, to boycott this year's Football World Cup because of what Donald Trump is doing in America? 0345 60 60 973 is the number to call. Your thoughts on that just after this.
The new LBC app. News your way. This is LBC.
Hi, Derek. Tara from Flash Designs here. Hope you're well. Not sure if you've seen my emails from last month, but could you please pay my invoice? Thank you so much. Bye. Hi, it's Tara, Flash Designs. Did you get my last voicemail? I know you're busy, but please pay my invoice today, if possible. Hello, again. It's Tara, again. Politely nudging, again.
Still chasing unpaid invoices? Let Sage Copilot help do the chasing so you can get paid up to 7 days faster. Search Sage Accountant today.
A Southern Train is a place where you can just switch off. Where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields. Or simply relax with a podcast, playlist, or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
Craig's never shown an interest in beekeeping before, but that's the sound of him buying 2,000 worker bees rather than doing his self-assessment. Craig, you live in a sixth-floor flat. The deadline is 31st of January. Less distraction, more action.
Don't be like Craig. Visit gov.uk/self-assessment today. Payment support may be available.
At Ocado, you'll save 25% on your first shop and get free delivery. Which means if you were to buy a four-cheese pizza, you'd basically be getting one of the cheeses for free. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Geographical and other restrictions. Minimum spend £60 and charges apply. New customers only. Maximum saving £20. Terms at ocado.com.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
11:19 the time. I'll be totally honest with you, that spent that advertising break googling how do I get England World Cup tickets. I'd left it too late. If anyone knows how you get them, they're sold out, I think. There's some here for $700 to watch England play Panama. I'd love to go, but I don't want to go that much. I would happily go to the US. I'd love to go to the US and watch England play in the World Cup, whatever I think of Donald Trump, because for me, they're totally separate things. But do you think that's wrong? Do you think actually that football and politics can't be kind of separated in that way? And that given the concerns, massive concerns, a lot of us have about what Trump is doing, would it be kind of hypocritical to go to the United States to watch football? I mean, presumably then you have to make the argument it'd be hypocritical to go there on holiday. You shouldn't be taking your kids to Disneyland Orlando because Donald Trump's cracking down on immigrants. I mean, seriously? Is that where we're going? Maybe we are. Let's talk to Jay in Willesden tonight. Hello, Jay.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure, mate.
As you may recall, I only ever call you when I disagree, so it's rare that I call you.
And Jay, it's been a while. So presumably you've been on the same page for the last few months.
Yeah, but boring radio for me when I agree with you. So a few things. I think Trump, we know, is a narcissist. I think you agree with that, right?
I absolutely agree with that, yep.
Yeah. So you've got to hit him where it hurts. And that means essentially boycotting the World Cup. That's the key thing. But there is another point that I think many, many months ago you argued that everyone should vote. I think I'm right in saying that.
I don't remember it, but it's absolutely my view, so I almost certainly
there
did.
You go. Yep. Yeah. But if you called a little earlier, a few minutes ago, you said it would be tokenistic to boycott the World Cup.
Yeah.
I would argue it's tokenistic. And there's actually a professor from Oxford or Cambridge University who argued it's actually irrational and tokenistic to vote, because your vote never, ever, ever, ever makes a difference, not only to the outcome of an election, but even to your local constituency. It's tokenistic.
Oh, Jay, I like this. This is clever, this
argument. It's tokenistic. It's not clever. It's just stating a fact.
No, it is. It's smart.
At the last election, Ben, did your vote make a difference to the outcome of who's PM even your local MP?
No, you're right, and I think you should do it anyway. And you're saying, well, actually, me not going to the World Cup's not going to make any difference at all, but it's a matter of principle.
Exactly. In the same way, voting is a point of principle. You should do it, even though you know, and every single one of your listeners knows, every single one of your listeners that voted at the last election knew it wasn't going to make diddly squat of a difference, but they still did it. Equally, if you go to the World Cup, you should have a guilty conscience, because you are essentially contributing that tiny 0.0001% towards Trump's ego.
Jay, I love it. I love the argument. I think it's very, very smart and clever. Is the difference, though, is the flaw in your argument, if there is one, respectfully, sir, that if none of us voted, we wouldn't really have a democracy or a government? If none of us went to the World Cup, nothing changes. It's still going to go ahead. It's not going to hurt Donald Trump in any way. So it wouldn't actually change anything.
Agree the World Cup would go ahead, but I mean, it's hypothetical, obviously, but if no one went to the World Cup, do you not think that would send a signal to Trump? Do you not think it would have some impact within the American, I was going to say American community, but the American population?
I don't think it would. I'm not being obtuse here, Jay. I honestly, hand on heart, don't think it would make a blind bit of difference at all.
I mean, Trump has been stung by what's happened in Minnesota. He's been stung by it. All the political commentators in America are saying he's been stung by the criticism of what's happening there. And that's a relatively small thing in the context of a World Cup, which is a global event. What's happening in one state in America is quite a compartmentalized issue. So imagine what a World Cup would do to him and the damage to his reputation, his ego and all the rest of it. So that's the point. I mean, you can make the argument on so many things. It's tokenistic. You know, going to a pro-Palestine march, 100,000 people went. Did one individual person make a difference?
Just because your individual action might not achieve anything, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. In the same way as, you know, me choosing to walk rather than drive the car because it's good for the planet is not going to stop climate change, but it's still a good thing to do. Maybe it's deeper for me. Maybe it's deeper for me. Maybe I still, despite what Donald Trump is doing, you can't get away from the fact that the US is a country that we are very allied to, that we have kind of inextricable military and diplomatic and cultural links to. If it was Russia, if it was even China, I think I'd feel slightly differently. But boycotting the US just because we don't like the current president just feels to me to be it feels silly.
Well, I think, I mean, you said it's our closest ally and all that, which I get. But I would say at this point now in 2026, our relationship with America is the weakest it's ever been in the history, in our history.
I agree with that, for sure.
Yep. And I think a lot of people in Britain or the UK today don't feel the same connection that they did with America 2 years ago, 3 years ago, or ever. So I think we're sort of living in the past when we say it's our greatest ally. Right. I think we need to reevaluate that position of how we see America now as a partner.
Let me chuck one other thing out of you. I've just been thinking about what you're saying, which is, as I say, I think is a really, really good point. If you don't vote, you know, I think you should, but you don't really lose out on much. Whereas for those, I've been to watch England in two World Cups. I've been very, very lucky. Mm. I will never forget those few weeks. They were some of the best memories of my life. Those England fans missing out on that for the point, because of a sort of political point or a gesture that you and I accept isn't going to achieve a great deal on an individual level. Isn't it about they stand to lose so much more than somebody just not turning up to vote?
Yeah, but I think it's about your personal conscience, isn't it? I mean, I'm a massive football fan. I would love to go to the World Cup in any country. But if I was offered free tickets to go to America, I wouldn't go. I can hand on heart say that.
I love them.
As a point of principle.
If you get offered free tickets, ring up the switchboard and tell them that Ben Kentish is going to take them off your hands. Is that all right?
I thought with your contact working at LBC, you'd have free tickets falling for your
every day. That'll be the day. I wish. Maybe when I'm Nick Ferrari. No, I'd happily go. So would you not even go on holiday to the US while Trump's president?
No, look, I'm an ethnic minority, so I wouldn't even feel safe with minority going. And I'm Muslim by faith as well, so I just would not go to America.
So you wouldn't actually feel comfortable. Fine, I get that.
I've got Muslim friends that have gone to America, and they've all been stopped, harassed at border control. Way am I going. So
I've never been to America. I must say.
Yeah.
Do you think the team should pull out? Do you think England, the football team, do you think the Keir Starmer and the FA should say, we are not going to take part in this competition?
I would love that to happen, but we know it's not going to happen. The team have got their own kind of like objective. I would love it to happen. I would love every country in the world to do that. We saw it with certain countries in the sport of cricket, and I think it made an impact. You look at South Africa, it made an impact. The world stood up and looked. And I think if you do it again, you know, but I think Israel should be boycotted as well from a World Cup, from tournaments, from Eurovision. I think it makes a difference. That makes a difference, but it needs the world community to stand up together against Russia, against America, against Israel, against North Korea, against China. It needs a global community to come together. Right. And it won't happen, which is the reality, unfortunately. Jay, but at least my conscience is clear.
I hear you. And I hear you. And we have a different sort of set of, you know, principles, I guess, as to whether or not we would feel comfortable going. Let me just bring in Susan to the conversation. Stay on the line, Jay, if you would. Susan's in Tolworth. Susan,
Hello, dear.
Hi, Susan. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, love.
Thank you for calling, Susan. You think we shouldn't boycott, is that right?
All these people that ring up are older. There's a lot of young people out there that need a bit of fun and laughter, and they've had enough of what's going on in the world. Give them a break. And if you've been, you're lucky. But they haven't.
Yep.
Give them a chance. They shouldn't keep domineering this attitude. Whatever we do, it won't make any difference.
But Jay's point is, if we all said that about everything, you know, we wouldn't bother to vote, we wouldn't bother to give to charity, we wouldn't do anything.
Well, I give to charity, and
me
I
too.
Do believe in giving to charity, and I don't believe in telling people what to do. I think people should have a freedom. If you're doing that, you're denying them a freedom of speech, freedom of everything. And then people moan that we don't have freedom.
So if you got free tickets, Susan, would you go?
I'm in my 70s now. I've never been anywhere like that. But if I had grandchildren,
yeah,
I would give them to them.
And you'd encourage them to go?
Well, to have some fun and meet other children from all nationalities. And they, I mean, after all, they had the Olympics in Russia. Yes. And have they all forgotten about this?
That's a really good point. And we had the Football World Cup in Qatar. We had the Olympics in China. We had the World Cup in Russia. Thank you, Susan. Lovely to talk to you. Jay, just on that. I mean, if we took part in all of those, we sent athletes to Beijing, we sent football, the football team to Russia and Qatar. If we now boycott the US, what signal does that send?
Yeah, agreed. Firstly, I'm friendly to Susan, thinks I'm old. I'm young. So I'm one of the young voices that is saying this. I think the point is that we know what China represents. We know what Russia represents. We know what these countries are about. America holds itself as being the greatest democracy in the world. We in the UK and Western Europe, generally, even throughout the world, we look at America as being the beacon of democracy.
Yeah.
Now, if the beacon of democracy is behaving in the way you're behaving,
if we boycott an event in America that we didn't boycott in Russia and Qatar, the message that that sends, Jay, surely, is that we think that Donald Trump is more egregious than Vladimir Putin and the Qatari emir.
No, I would look at it the other way around. I would say we're now saying the greatest democracy in the world is terrible. What is left in this world? There is no hope left in the world. It's the greatest democracy in the world.
It's a hell of a lot stronger as a democracy than Vladimir Putin's Russia.
It is. But even Ian Dale, I think yesterday, was talking on the radio about, you know, do we need to start questioning whether someone was sort of saying, do we need to start questioning whether America is actually a democracy anymore, given what it's doing?
It's certainly less of one than it was before Donald Trump. It's also certainly more of one than Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Yeah.
All right. I've got to leave it there. Lots of calls to get through. Thank you very much indeed. We'll speak again next time we disagree. Hopefully it'll be a while, in the nicest possible way. Thank you, Jay, in Wills, and thank you to Susan in Tolworth as well. More of your calls to come. Should England and Scotland boycott the World Cup simply because of Donald Trump? Jay says yes. Susan says no. What say you? Plus,
Holocaust Memorial Day, a day for remembering the 6 million people who were murdered by the Nazi regime over 80 years ago.
Why the BBC has had to apologise yet again to the Jewish community today, this time over the corporation's coverage of Holocaust Memorial Day yesterday. Bring the details on that story right after the news headlines. 11:30 the time. Here's Daryl Jackson.
Iran says it will defend itself if pushed, but is ready to discuss its nuclear programme with the US. Donald Trump has warned a massive US naval force is headed for the Middle East, and time is running out for a deal. At least two federal agents involved in the death of US citizen Alex Preti in Minneapolis on Saturday have been suspended. US media says they were put on leave as part of standard procedures. And a danger to life flood warning's been issued in Dorset after Storm Chandra brought heavy rain and strong winds. Homes have been evacuated near Christchurch, and a lorry driver died in a weather-related crash in the New Forest in Hampshire. LBC weather: fog lingering in central and eastern areas tomorrow, mostly cloudy with the odd bright spell in places. Some light rain in the northeast of Scotland and the southwest, a high of 10 degrees.
This is LBC.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
Nothing beats that just booked feeling. Because when you book a Jet2 holiday, you start dreaming of pool days and seeing the sights. Get ahead for summer. Book now with just a £60 deposit per person. Choose from our best rooms and hotels and save £200 per couple. Nothing beats a Jet2 holiday. Package holidays you can trust. Action National Protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
To be or not to be.
Right now, we're offering a range of incentives across Audi models.
That is the...
But only until the 28th of February.
The,
So stop whatever you're doing.
I'll be right back. Just carry on without me.
And find yours online or at your local Audi centre. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik. Terms and conditions apply. Selected models, retail customers and participating Audi centres only.
Hi Derek, Tara from Flash Designs here, hope you're well. Not sure if you've seen my emails from last month, but could you please pay my invoice? Thank you so much. Bye.
Hi, it's Tara, Flash Designs. Did you get my last voicemail? I know you're busy, but please pay my invoice today, if possible. Hello, again. It's Tara, again. Politely nudging, again.
Still chasing unpaid invoices? Let Sage Copilot help do the chasing so you can get paid up to 7 days faster. Search Sage Accountant today.
This is LBC with Ben Kentish. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
I've changed my mind. I'd absolutely boycott it. Don't go. Tell the team to go on holiday this summer instead. I've just looked at the ticket prices. Cheapest available tickets. Resale, this is. Official resale. England v Panama in New York. $650. Are they having a laugh? Is that what they're charging? People to go and watch their team? Outrageous. That's scandalous. See with the Sean in Exeter. Thinks we should boycott it in a couple of minutes' time. I want to talk first, though, about the latest apology from the BBC today to Britain's Jewish community. After a series of news reports on Holocaust Memorial Day yesterday referred to the 6 million people that were killed in the Holocaust by the Nazis. The problem with that, of course, being that more than 6 million people were killed, 8 million people were killed, 6 million Jews were killed. And yet across a whole host of BBC programmes, there was no mention of the fact that those 6 million victims were Jewish, something the BBC has today admitted was an omission and something worthy of an apology over. Yet the Jewish community, once again, saying this is just the latest example of us feeling let down and betrayed by our national broadcaster. Let's talk about it with Alex Hearn, co-director of a Labour Against Anti-Semitism campaign group. Alex, right that they've apologised. Is it an apology you accept?
It's difficult to accept. I mean, I've started to dread Holocaust Memorial Day. It's become the day when Jews were erased twice. And the BBC are really important because of their global reach, as well as us funding them. But when Jewish identity consistently disappears from BBC coverage of anti-Jewish persecution, no less, that's difficult to pass as a coincidence. It seems more like editorial policy. It's historical vandalism and really poor journalism that instead of naming this hate, Jewish suffering is treated as controversial, or that maybe Jews can never be seen as victims. It feels like the BBC is conforming to a racist climate and they can only ever see us as villains, this kind of culturally ingrained archetype, like a Shylock or a Fagin, you know. And now Jewish victimhood in the Holocaust feels like it's become some kind of plot device in a generic morality tale stripped of real meaning. Let's not forget the context of the Holocaust was the European obsession with race, and the Nazis were completely obsessed by Jews and the demonization of Jews, and that has been wiped out. That's what this does, and it absolves the conscience of a culture. And I just want to mention here that it's not just the BBC. I've recognized the BBC's importance, but the UN Geneva posted something which completely didn't mention Jews. The Green Party also did. This has become routine with UK councils, politicians making Holocaust Memorial Day statements with no mention of Jews. You know, even the Irish president, Michael Higgins, used the Holocaust Memorial Day to make a statement against Israel. Jews turned their backs and some were dragged out by security. So the message is, Jews, shut up about the Holocaust. And it feels like this has become a war on memory, even in schools. You know, the number of UK schools marking Holocaust Memorial Day has collapsed, and teachers have cited fears of a backlash. But we mustn't forget the specificity of the Holocaust is the Nazi obsession about Jews, which made Jews the primary target. And the BBC, of all people doing this, is really, really poor journalism. And I can't pass it by as a mistake, especially given their...
Why not, Alex? Because I completely agree. It's absolutely shoddy journalism. It's factually wrong as much as anything else. And that's even before you get to the offence that it's caused. But, you know, some people might say, well, yeah, it's bad. It's right they apologise, but it's just an innocuous mistake. It was just poorly written. Why do you think it's something more sort of sinister than that?
Well, let me put it this way. the BBC have hired staff who have said Hitler was right and to burn the Jews. And not much has been done against it, about it. They pushed back against anti-Semitism training. A dossier of incidents presented by Jewish staff was completely dismissed. So I would like to know what is actually going to happen as a result of this. Because
It's the fact
my guess is going to be nothing.
It's not an isolated incident, as you say. It's part of a broader, a broader issue with the Jewish community.
It is. I mean, their highest paid presenter called, you know, posted, Gary Lineker posted that rat meme, for goodness sake. And he got to see out Match of the Day. He got to carry on as the presenter. So it's really difficult to believe that anything genuine is going to happen as a result of this.
Thank you, Alex, for coming on the programme. Alex Hearn, co-director of the Labour Against Anti-Semitism campaign group. I've worked in journalism for quite a long time now. I don't understand how that happens. These scripts, they get written, they get looked at, they get signed off, the presenter reads them. Did nobody in any of those programmes stop and think, hold on, should we not mention the fact that the 6 million people were Jewish? Is that not pertinent here? Is that not relevant? Is that not better journalistic standards than just saying, oh, people? And that's before you get to the fact it's not even 8 million people were killed. There were a lot of 2 million non-Jews were killed in the Holocaust. It's just wrong. And it wasn't just one station, it was various programmes of various stations, and nobody, as part of those conversations or those production teams, thought, hang on, I think we should change this. This isn't quite right. I genuinely don't understand how that happens. I don't think it's malicious. But I do think it perhaps suggests that there is a kind of, you know, what Alex was talking about, there are an issue about being uncomfortable with being direct about the fact that most of the victims of the Holocaust, in fact, the vast majority, were Jews. Why is that controversial? Why should that be sort of difficult to just be upfront and explicit about? It baffles me. It really, really does. Let me know your thoughts on it. 0345 6060 973 for your calls and your WhatsApps. 84850 for the text. How offensive is it? Is it a sign of a deeper issue with the BBC when it comes to the Jewish community? A lot of Jewish people think it is. Do you think they're right to? It is 20 to 12. Let me come back to your thoughts for now on Donald Trump, the World Cup that's taking place later this year in the US, along with Canada and Mexico, and call today for England, or at least England fans, to boycott the tournament in protest at what Donald Trump is doing as president. Sean's calling from Exeter to carry on that conversation. Evening, Sean.
Yes, good evening to you. Just quickly on that last note regarding that, what's your personal opinion on what's happened? Because you're from that community, aren't you? The religion
on the BBC. I think it is
because you're Jewish, aren't you?
Yeah, so I think it's part of a systemic issue. And that is, if it was one or two things, Sean, then, you know, I think it's kind of, you give them the benefit of the doubt. But it does seem to be a sort of a symptomatic issue of a broader problem. Yeah, what do you make of it?
What I'm trying to say is, have you felt yourself being racist against you, like in the community? That's what I'm trying to say. Have you had any negative or anything?
From who?
Well, because you're Jewish, aren't you? So have you had anything from, you know, like the Reform or anybody being horrible, or like, have you felt it? No. No.
Because Reform.
Well, like from, because you hear about it. I mean,
anti-Semitism is a massive problem. I see it all the time. I see it most days.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. So I don't see it because I'm somewhere.
Yes, all the time, Sean, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say. So I feel for you because I'm not from that community. I'm asking you, like.
But I don't think what happened yesterday is anti-Semitic, but I do think it's really poor journalistic standards.
Well, I was just going to. I can't believe what's gone off, and I feel sorry for you guys. When I say you guys, your community and things, what's happened, and, you know, like I said, I only hear about it when I'm on LBC, when I hear it, because it's on LBC a lot, and which is good. It's on everywhere else, but
this isn't even about anti-Semitism, I don't think. I don't think you have to be Jewish to think that erasing the Jewish element of Holocaust Memorial is a problem. Most people in their right mind would see that as an issue, wouldn't they?
I would never. I mean, sorry about talking about. I just say it wasn't so. But like Kentish, you would never. It's not like a Rothstein surname, is it? Like Kentish, like you would never see it.
What's your point, Sean?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that people that do stand out, be more, I guess, like with the, you know, wearing the, is it the kippah? I can't remember the hat. So anyway, let's move on to this subject. I'm talking about.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. Should
we? I'm learning.
That's fine. Should England and Scotland boycott the World Cup? Do you think?
Yes, they should. And the reason why I say that is because we're living in peculiar times at the moment, where I don't want to spoil your fun and everybody else that loves football, because I like football, but there's more important things in the game of football at the moment, and that is trying to change the world for everybody. I'm somebody that's of a young, I say, age, so the last lovely lady, old lady in her 70s, fair enough, but she's like my mother, where she's a conservative voter, says, oh, we got to do this, do that, but does absolutely nothing. My dad, who's a Labour person, does all the work kind of thing, you know. She just sits there and watches TV. Mm. So at the same time, I think we need to do a lot more. Every single one of us of all ages, we're living in very peculiar times, and the only way you can change things is to stand up and say, we're not going to be part of this corruption. There's been more corruption in the last 100 years, trust me.
But are we part of it just because we play in a tournament in that country? We're part of Putin's, you know, repression and corruption when we went and played football in Russia as England.
Yeah, 100%. It's really? Literally like pouring poison. You know, it's like pouring poison to the devil or drinking with the devil. It's as simple as that. You're adding to the flames, not you personally.
How does you know, Harry Kane leading his team out against Panama in New York, for which you pay $650 if you want to go and watch it, by the way. How does that in any way kind of, you know, deepen what, or further or worsen what Donald Trump is doing politically?
The protests, be it within the Civil War in America, even when the women, you're more clever than me, but with the women when they, you know, they stood up for their rights.
What, America, the suffragettes?
The suffragettes. And what happened, you explained to me and everybody else, the suffragettes, what happened with the suffragettes is they had no power back then in war and black people and things, but because they had protests, and they kept, you know, can you imagine what they went through? No advertising, like they didn't have LBC back then, so they had to do it from groundwork. So we are so lucky to stand up and say no, and we're going to do this, and we're going to have signs up, and we're going. And what's happening in Minnesota at the moment? Do you think Donald Trump turned? He did his U-turn because of because his partner felt sorry. All they've been caught out. The rug's been pulled from under their feet, and as I said to Nick Farr, he's got older eyes than me, we all saw what we saw, didn't we, and he agreed.
So would you say, Sean, the more we make Donald Trump a kind of international pariah,
this is the only power we've got, my friend,
the more he will feel the pressure to change and adapt what he's doing domestically?
1,000%.
I take your point. I mean, it would have to be a concerted effort, wouldn't it? If it was just England, or if it was just England fans, it would be a bit pointless.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what power do you think we do have? What can we do other than this? I mean, we're against this.
The honest answer to that, Sean, is not a lot, if I'm honest with you. I don't want to sound defeatist here.
My 70-year-old lady earlier, just do nothing, just ring into LBC and just, you know, let everybody else do the work.
The only thing I think we can do is put pressure on our political leaders to take a stand. But I like your kind of, you know, your determination to do whatever small thing you can. I think we'll have to disagree on the idea that England fans not turning up would have any impact at all.
This is what it's all about, isn't it? Agreeing and disagreeing. But totally.
Sean, lovely to talk to you. Got to leave it there because we've got lots of calls to get through. But thank you very much indeed for getting in touch. That was Sean in Exeter. More calls to come. Sean said, look, it might not change a great deal, but we've got to do what we can. Again, I get the argument. I respect it. I don't think I agree with it, though. Maybe you do. 0345 60 60973 for your calls. Should England follow the advice of Sepp Blatter, former FIFA president, no less, admittedly a discredited one, and boycott the 2026 World Cup? Ben Kentish here on LBC. The time, 11:46.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The BBC have done it again and managed to offend their Jewish viewers, listeners and readers by omitting the word Jew or Jewish from coverage of Holocaust Memorial Day.
27th of January, Holocaust Memorial Day, a day for remembering the 6 million people who were murdered by the Nazi regime over 80 years ago.
Wrong, wrong, wrong! The 6 million were the Jewish people. It is more than 8 million. How can you be so factually incorrect? As I said before, in the unlikely event that I'd ever had a senior position at the BBC, we have had a shocking, shocking 12 months. We are going to do this right. We're going to have absolute coverage of Holocaust. But even then, they're in Holocaust denial.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to the CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours, I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
Another early morning gym session skipped. Some New Year's resolutions set you up to fail. But a new Mazda CX-30 is the one you will want to keep. Available with 0% APR and a £750 deposit contribution during the Mazda January sale. Order by the 31st of January. Search Mazda. Available on PCP when financed by Mazda Financial Services by the 31st of March 26. Indemnities may be required. Terms apply. Participating dealers. See website.
Quick question. Well, actually three, but they are quick. One, do you have a car? Two, are you looking to save on your car insurance? And three, do you have a Tesco club card? Well, if you do, you could get exclusive club card prices when you take out or renew a policy with Tesco Car Insurance. And with three levels of cover available, you can choose the one that's right for you. Over a million club card members are already saving money. So just search online for Tesco Car Insurance.
EasyJet's Big Orange Sale is now on. Beat the blues and book the beach with up to £500 off package holidays and up to 25% off flights. EasyJet. Get out there. Selected dates and flights. Flight sale ends 3rd of Feb. Holiday sale ends 3rd of March. Min spend and ATOL protected. T's and C's apply.
It's not easy being a clamp stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7. I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself.
Hey, Clampy. How's it going?
Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely.
Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
Leading Britain's conversation. Ben Kentish. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 10 to 12. Talk about to Will in Marylebone about whether or not England and England fans should boycott the World Cup in just a minute. First, though, Morgan's corner from Hendon. Morgan, you wanted to pick up about the BBC apologising for failing to mention Jews in some report when it came in some reports about Holocaust Memorial Day. Please, Morgan.
Yes, hi, good evening there.
Evening.
Yeah, I'm part of the Jewish community. I'm 20 years old, going to uni currently. I'm stuck with this in the UK at the moment with the anti-Semitism obviously rising and obviously the disgrace of this actual government that is treating the Jewish community and other people in a disrespectful way. And I just feel that the BBC are keep on going on and on and on about obviously failing with the Jewish community, and it's getting to a point where I'm fed up with it. I'm part of the Jewish community. I give a lot to the Jewish community and I'm not feeling safe living in my hometown where I was born.
When you say the government, you think the government's feeding into this, Morgan. What do you think the government is doing to kind of perpetuate it?
So I think the government are not doing enough to stop this. I think the BBC, the broadcasting of the radio station, is a big part of the government.
But the government, I've got to point out, Morgan, that of course the government doesn't control the BBC. It's editorially completely independent.
Correct. I just feel that the whole situation of the Jewish community has got to a point where no one can trust anymore. If it's the government, if it's the broadcasting, if it's news reporters, if it's even walking daily in the street with people calling out, this is a Jewish person because of the symbols, because of wearing a yarmulke, or because of wearing a tzitzit, or because of coming out of shul. And I feel very strong about this because I've lived in Israel for 8 years, and when I come back here to the streets, I can't wear a yarmulke and I can't go to shul and I can't be proud to be a Jew at the moment in the UK.
Because what, you feared that you would be the victim of violence? Abuse?
100%.
And the fact that the BBC's apologised and said, yeah, we'll put this right, it was an omission. Do you sort of accept the apology?
No, not at all. I think it's, yet again, I think it's with a big full stop that you can't stop saying sorry about things when you keep on going on about, if I wanted to go and steal something, I can't keep on saying sorry, can I? So I don't know what the same.
What do you think the issue is more? Because, I mean, obviously you're right to say this is not the first time that an apology has been issued in relation to coverage of the Israel war or issues that are also obviously pertinent to the Jewish community. What do you think, you know, what's behind it? What's the problem?
I think the big problem is that, to be fair, I don't know what the big problem is, but all I do know is, with a big, big capital letters, is Jews have always been hated. Jews has always been like the headline of everything. And because of the conflict that was in Gaza lately, and because of what is going on in Israel, people don't understand that Jewish people are being are being targeted here in every way possible.
Morgan, I hear you, and you speak for a lot of people. Thank you very much indeed for the call. Maybe you agree with Morgan, maybe you disagree with Morgan's perspective. Thank you for calling in there, Morgan. Let's talk to Willie Marlebone about Donald Trump. Should we boycott the World Cup this summer because of him, Will? What do you think?
Absolutely not.
Well,
I'm a massive, massive football fan.
Who do you support,
Arsenal.
Oh, man. It's your year, I think, isn't it?
I'm not so sure. I think we're going to bottle
it. You can't bottle it again. Come on.
Oh,
believe.
I think
have
we
some
might.
Faith.
I don't. I've got none.
For your sake, I hope it is. Well, go on, why shouldn't we boycott the World Cup?
Well, because I don't think it would make a blind bit of difference to how Trump behaves. We obviously, from what we're hearing, the behaviour from the government, you know, with ICE and stuff, it sounds terrible. But when at the end of the day, we are not there. You know, we need. So many people, especially normal working people, need this World Cup. They really need it. Yeah, we need it.
Why do we need it? And I love it, Will. I'm with you. But do we need it?
Well, I think mental health, you know, it makes a big difference. You know, having that big summer tournament, which we look forward to every 4 years. Obviously, we have the Euros, so every 2 years, we have a big summer tournament. And I just feel, maybe it's just me, you know, it's like how I feel. Maybe I'm being selfish. And people, I respect people who feel, you know, that the right way to go is to boycott. But, you know, where are we going to draw the line? Are we going to all start boycotting Chinese products as well?
Yeah.
Because I reckon Keir Starmer's, a lot of these people are saying this.
Yeah, Keir Starmer's literally there this week, isn't he? Shaking hands. So,
yeah.
It's got to be consistent. I'm with you, Will. I don't know about the mental health part, but it is it's one of the few times that the country comes together, isn't it? I mean, we're quite divided, I think it's fair to say, as a nation right now. And the World Cup gives all of us, in England at least, and in Scotland this summer as well, a reason to come together and kind of join forces in supporting our team. And I think not having that would be bad for the country.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, you know, that's how we get on with one another. It brings everyone together, you know. And if we start turning our backs on other nations, you know, whatever we think of, you know, their government, all it does is divide. You know, it's not going to help. And actually, we're sucking the joy out of life as well. You know, because where do you draw the line with, you know, the boycotting?
Would you go, Will, if you could?
Yeah, definitely. If I had the money, if I had the time.
It's only $650 for as cheap as ticket.
Pennies.
That is outrageous. Nothing. That is absolutely scandalous. Thank you, Will. Always love having you on the show. Thanks for the call tonight. Grace in Ealing. Grace, should we boycott? Will says no. I say no. What about you? Hi.
I would say probably boycott. Can I just quickly say something? I don't want to sound really argumentative, but my mental health problem is an eating disorder. But on behalf of people whose mental health problems are depression or others, I'd kind of think it might be better if people didn't suggest that you could cure mental health problems by watching football. We throw the phrase around mental health all the time, and I get that everyone has, you know, mental health and everyone has a mood, but a real mental health problem is a serious clinical issue that you can't just resolve as simply as that. And I kind of feel like we negate the severity of things like clinical depression.
It's a very reasonable thing to point out. I guess if you framed it slightly differently, you said, look, there's a lot of tough people are living through a lot of tough times right now. A bit of joy provided by the England football team is not something to be taken lightly. It is a benefit to the country. That's how I would put it.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I sound very argumentative.
No, you don't.
I can imagine people who've got serious depression that's ruining their lives here,
yes,
and that. But we are, yeah, we're living in a messy world, and as a prior caller said, I think things are really being, I don't know, turned upside down in a way, and that the supposed pinnacle of democracy is in a very strange place. And obviously, and unfortunately, America has done some really destructive things in the world for a long time that don't get enough attention. You could argue that we should be boycotting it because of how it's been exploiting other parts of the world via its corporations for a long time. But what we've got now is a particular egomaniac in the White House. Mm. I mean, I thought when he was given this fake Nobel Peace Prize about how last year he's at a funeral said that he hates his opponents and doesn't want the best for them. He had Erica Kirk stand up and say, you know, Jesus told us to love our enemies, which is something that a lot of American people, because of the kind of the Christian population in America, would have been familiar with. It's, you know, that they talk about these kinds of things over there fairly often. And yet, Donald Trump decided to stand up and say, no, he hates his opponents. And then he was given a Nobel Peace Prize.
But Grace, what would it actually achieve? We agree about Donald Trump. But if England fans don't go to the World Cup, if they miss out on that wonderful opportunity, if they are lucky enough to have the means and the tickets and the ability to go, Donald Trump's not going to know or care, is he?
Well, I just feel like he's the only... trying to get to his ego is the only thing that could make an impact.
What if makes him angry and he says, right, I don't like these English people anymore. I'm gonna hit tariffs on the UK and stop sharing intelligence with the US, the UK military.
I don't imagine that he would be able to justify actions like that on the basis of a boycott of a tournament. I think it could be the one thing that could get to his feelings just a tiny bit if he felt dejected.
Maybe. Maybe, we'll see. I don't think it's going to happen, and for one, I don't think it should. Can I go? I don't know. Can I get tickets? We'll see. Thank you very much indeed for the call, Grace. Other things to talk about after the news at 12. Rachel Reeves today insisting that the student loan system is fair. Nick Clegg said it's not. Who's right?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, a minister in Tehran says Iran's armed forces have their fingers on the trigger to immediately respond to any aggression after threats from America. US President Donald Trump says a massive armada of US ships is on its way to the Middle East unless a deal's reached over Iran's nuclear program. Dr. Arash Azizi is an Iranian-American historian and writer. He's told LBC Donald Trump isn't set on military action.
I think he prefers some sort of a deal, but he wants a real deal. Like, he wants the regime to give up so much. And if they don't do it, I think he will take action. He's trigger happy when he needs to be. So I think it's quite likely that we'll have some sort of an action, unless the regime is really able to take some drastic action, to some deal making, which I don't really see.
Sir Keir Starmer's told business delegates they are making history as he kicked off his trip to China. It's the first time a prime minister has travelled to Beijing since Theresa May in 2018. The police watchdog has paused misconduct proceedings against the police marksman who shot and killed Chris Cabot in South London. The IOPC says it wants to await the implications of a legal change over the tests used to bring action against officers over the use of force. Martin Blake was cleared of the 24-year-old's murder in Streatham in September 2022. The Chancellor has told LBC the current student loan system is fair, despite a former Deputy Prime Minister warning it needs an overhaul. Sir Nick Clegg says it's worth considering to tackle levels of graduate debt amid concerns it's spiralling. Rachel Reeves insists people only pay it back when they can afford to do so.
So if you are able to get a job that pays a good wage, you'll pay that money back quicker. But if you're never able to repay, that loan will eventually be written off. I think that is a fair system. Around half of people go to university today, but half don't. And it is not right that people who don't go to university are having to bear all the cost for others to do so.
A danger to life flood warning's been reimposed in Dorset after Storm Chandra. Residents of a home park by the River Stour near Christchurch have been told to leave as quickly as possible. A lorry driver died yesterday in a weather-related crash in the New Forest.
LBC weather, fog lingering in central and eastern areas later. Mostly cloudy with the odd bright spell in places. Some light rain in northeast Scotland and the southwest. A high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ben Kentish.
Three, the time, Thursday morning. Very, very good morning to you. Ben Kentish here with you on LBC. A row today, a political row over student loans and specifically the interest that students today have to pay. Because not only do they have to pay fees far greater than even my generation had to pay for an education that, of course, their parents and grandparents who went to university got absolutely free, they now also have to pay pretty hefty interest rates on the loans that they are taking out. They have to, that interest accrues even when they aren't paying it back. It was reported here this week that millions of students are paying off less of their loans than they are getting hit with in interest payments. In fact, that they're paying off some of the loan, but because of the interest, the sum that they owe is going up and up and up. And the political row that's broken out today is whether the system that's currently in place for funding universities, the system of tuition fee loans that are subject to hefty interest payments, and I'll give you the details in a moment, is fair. And interestingly, Nick Clegg, who you might well say doesn't have a, or Sir Nick Clegg, I think he now is, doesn't have a particularly strong record on standing up for students, given he very infamously betrayed his promise to students when he was part of the coalition government, Deputy Prime Minister, that trebled tuition fees. Even he's been standing up for students today. Maybe it's a guilty conscience, who knows. But he spoke to Nick Ferrari on LBC here yesterday morning. He had this to say about student fees.
I think it's become way too complex and convoluted. It feels really, I think a lot of young people feel that they're now just running to stand still. I mean, remember...
Well, they're not even standing still. They've got 8% interest in something.
Yeah, but remember
this
when
is
we...
making money off kids. I know you're not the architect now, but I mean, this is absurd, isn't it?
Yes, but I can't... it is a completely different system now to what we introduced in 2012. Then it was RPI plus 3%, but crucially, you only had to start paying back. We very much increased the point at which you had to start paying back to, I think it was 25,000.
It's 28
at the
now.
I know, it should arguably have gone up. They froze that threshold. We introduced maintenance, meaningful maintenance grants, which the Conservatives got rid of the moment we were got rid of from Downing Street. It was a 30-year repayment thing. I think it's now 40 years. And crucially, of course, remember, the effect of that was firstly to exempt universities from austerity, from the difficult savings we had to make, which any government had to, in the post-2008 years. But also you had European students coming here paying full fees, which of course have all now been, most of them now been chased back home because of Brexit. So the situation is very different. The labour market is much tougher than it's been in recent years for graduates. So I think it is definitely worth thinking of a real overhaul now. This doesn't seem to be, the governments just seem to be tinkering rather than looking in the round about how to make university finances sustainable and make it fairer for graduates.
Chancellor Rachel Reeves, though, disagrees.
Well, it is important that you don't have to start paying back the student loan until you earn enough money. And that is the point of the student loan system, that you get the loan, you get that great university education, and you only pay it back if you can afford to do so. And obviously, after a period of time, that gets written off entirely. So if you are able to get a job that pays a good wage, you'll pay that money back quicker. But if you're never able to repay, that loan will eventually be written off. I think that is a fair system. Around half of people go to university today, but half don't. And it is not right that people who don't go to university are having to bear all the cost for others to do so.
I don't want to be rude, and I really don't want to be mean here, but I've got to ask the question, what is the point of Rachel Reeves in the job that she currently holds? What is the point of a Labour Chancellor who gets to that office, who is in charge of all, has all the power at her fingertips, and thinks that young, low-paid, hard-working graduates being clobbered with interest rates of, in some cases, 8%, meaning they are accruing more and more and more debt, however hard they try to pay off the loans for the education, by the way, that Rachel Reeves didn't pay a penny for, because she didn't have to pay tuition fees. What is the point of being a Labour Chancellor? What does it say about her priorities that she thinks it's fair
that those graduates are being used as a cash cow in that way. And another thing that Rachel Reeves thinks is fair, by the way, is the triple lock on pensions. And people say, oh, you're going on about that again. Yeah, I'm going on about that again. Because what is happening here is young people are being asked to pay through the teeth more than any generation ever had to pay for their university education. And interest now as well being added. Rachel Reeves thinks that's fair. Fine. Rachel Reeves also thinks it's fair that some of that money and more of taxpayers' money is going to maintain the triple lock on pensions that sees more and more, billions more every year, given to pensioners, regardless of how wealthy that pensioner is. How is that fair? So I'm with Nick Clegg. The system is absolutely rotten. Consecutive governments, and I'm afraid to say Rachel Reeves is the latest chancellor to do it, have used young graduates as a cash cow, asking them to pay more and more and more, that they can't afford, by the way, that they can't afford. You start paying about 28 grand. That's less than the average salary. In order to maintain and increase the spending that is going on older generations. That's the reality, and people won't like the truth, but that is what is going on. So, shame on Rachel Reeves for defending, I think, the indefensible. Fair play to Nick Clegg. Might have been 15 years too late, but at least he's now finally standing up for students and young graduates. The system is absolutely rotten, I say it again. Is it not? I'm with Nick Clegg on this, and not Rachel Reeves, but I want your thoughts on it. Is it fair to ask university students to pay £9,500 in fees? Of course, figures that very few people could afford to pay. That's why most people have to get student loans. And then on those student loans, which of course the wealthiest students don't have to pay, hit them with interest of inflation plus 3%, which means some graduates in recent years have been paying 8% interest on their loans. If you got wealthy parents, you don't need the loan. They just pay your fees outright, right? So this hits the middle classes and the lower classes hardest, and this Labour Chancellor thinks it's fair. Do you? Or are you with Nick Clegg that this is a system that needs completely tearing up and rethinking? If you're a graduate, if you're at university now, particularly interested to hear from you about how this affects you and your finances and your bank balance, because those interest payments, by the way, come out your salary. That's money you can't spend on the rent. It's money you can't put towards a deposit. It's money you can't spend on having a social life or trying to start a family. And Rachel Reeves thinks it's fair. On what planet is this system fair? And what is the point of a Labour Chancellor who thinks it is? 0345 606 0973 is the number. You can text 84850 or say, Alexa, send a comment to LBC. Let's talk to Ollie Dogmore about it, executive editor of The New Statesman. Ollie, very good morning to you. Rachel Reeves says this system is fair. Is it?
No. It's absolutely not fair. The student loan system has various intricacies and different layers to it. You know, my personal experience, I'm on plan two. I'm one of the first graduates that was blessed with paying £9,000 a year for their university tuition. And unless you are well off enough to pay those tuition fees up front, and, you know, good for you if you are, you deal with that 27K straight off the bat, no problems, no questions asked, and you don't get charged interest on it. I, on the other hand, was charged interest from the day that I enrolled in university. Before I'd had a single hour of lectures, I started paying interest on the money I borrowed from the government. In fact, the interest that was charged to that loan was so extensive that it took me 10 years. I enrolled in 2012. It wasn't until I was working in 2022 that I was earning enough to actually start to reduce the amount of money I owed the student finance company. It was increasing the entire time over that period. So it's regressive for that reason. And I'll just add one extra in there, Ben, is that if you're a woman and you are lucky enough to start a family, take some time off work, maybe you're on mat leave, maybe you're self-employed, you can afford to take the time off, whatever it is, you stop repaying. The interest carries on. So not only is it to the benefit of the much wealthier.
I didn't realise.
But it also penalises women too.
You carry on accruing interest even when you're not actually paying off the loan.
You carry on accruing interest the whole way through. Does it? You know, if you're below the earnings threshold, you'll accrue interest. And obviously until, and this is where obviously it does differ from regular debt, you reach that sort of time horizon, 30 years, and then it gets wiped. So essentially it functions as a graduate tax, 9% of your salary for going to university.
It's crazy, isn't it? Going to university and getting the same education that, of course, this generation's parents and grandparents got absolutely free.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the point. You know, the ministers that implemented this, how much did they pay?
for their tuition.
Zero.
Yeah, well, exactly. Now, look, you know, I'm not as much of a red rag waving socialist as some people would believe. Like, there are alternative options here, you know, but I think if we're talking about a different model and how it might work, we have all sorts of skill gaps across the British economy. You might want to talk about nurses. You might want to talk about engineers. Well, how about targeting for degrees like that? You could pay no fees for those, couldn't you? We could stimulate people into studying those things, because I don't know about you, Ben, but I feel like education is a little bit more of a public good than it is a commodity.
Yes, and that's the issue that, I mean, I'm interested in your thoughts, Zoe, but that's the issue that I have with the kind of Rachel Reeves argument, as she's put to LBC, that, well, if you go to university, you're the one that benefits from it, and therefore it's totally fair that you should sort of pay more, not just in the actual repayments, but in interest too, because you're paying for a benefit that you've got that other people didn't. Your thoughts on that argument?
Yeah, look, I mean, there is a graduate premium, you know, it is true. It varies country by country. And actually, compared to our European neighbours, the UK actually performs quite a lot worse than many of our European neighbours who provide university education for free. So we could ruminate upon that. But let's say, I think it's about 150 grand your lifetime earnings will improve by if you go to university. And it's possible that if you're a high earner, you may well pay back somewhere between 40 and maybe 100 grand over the course of that time. So it does kind of wear it down. But there's this point about the interest, and again, talking about generational fairness, right? We have this thing called the triple lock when it comes to pensions, and I'm supportive of it. Like, at the end of the day, it's actually a really effective measure. Pensioner poverty is a real issue, and it's alleviated it, and we should applaud that. It's a great thing that we've done. We have a reverse triple lock on a lot of these student loans, whereby if you earn more, you are charged more interest, i.e. it takes you longer to pay it back. Now, most commercial financial products, if you've got a high salary, you earn more, they might give you a slightly better interest rate because they take a view that you're going to pay back the money. They can take less of a borrowing risk, and they want your custom because you're going to repay them back. So they offer you a slightly more competitive interest rate. The opposite happens with student loans. You have a reverse triple lock. Oh, you're doing well, earning more money. Doesn't matter. We're going to charge you more.
It's this sort of typical generational divide that we're seeing, where inflation is used to basically squeeze more and more out of young graduates, low paid, perhaps even workless young graduates who are accruing more and more debt. And the same sort of, you know, inflation system and link is used to make sure that the pensioners get more and more per year of taxpayers' money, regardless of how well off they are.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing for me, Ben, is, you know, I'll accept the argument. If you say, do you know what? I still think whoever goes to university should pay the cost. Fine. Let's have a graduate tax that the rich can't opt out of, that doesn't disadvantage pregnant women, working women in that way. It's absolutely fine. I'll take your point. The counter for me, though, is if we want to take seriously the fact that the most common living arrangement for young men in this country, men my age in their 30s, used to be with their spouse, and it is now with their parents.
Yep.
Let's have a little think about what giving them 9% of their income might do to not only their prospects in the dating pool, but if you want to be really sort of treasury-brained about it, effective economic agents. What would that extra 9% do for their purchasing power? What would it allow them to buy? What would it do for the squeezed middle in this country? So there's a variety of arguments I think you can wield against it.
Just lastly, let's just talk about the politics of this for a moment. I mean, do you think Labour is going to have to do something about student loans and student interest, whether that's the fees themselves that are going up and up and up under this Labour government, or the sort of clamour now for some sort of rethink on the interest rates as well? Or is the brutal reality that because sort of students are nowhere near as likely to vote as older people, this is a kind of a campaign that Rachel Reeves is going to be absolutely able to ignore?
Yeah, depends what you get into politics for, I guess, Ben. Is it for power, or is it to make people's lives better? And just because it isn't necessarily a vote winner doesn't mean it's something that you shouldn't do. Look, I think in terms of remediation, it's pretty complicated and excessive to sort of go talk about wiping student debts, you know, forgiveness in the way that they sometimes operate in the United States.
That's,
I think you could look at
an approach as well, of course.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Look, I think you could look at limiting the interest. I think you could look at reducing the payment term. You know, some of the most recent cohort of graduates, it's not 30 years anymore, it's 40. So they're going to be paying it back into their 60s. Bring that down to 30. I think that's reasonable. I think you could target the support. You could make some courses free where you want to train more people. These are all various options, and I think they would go a long way. I know that there are people who are senior in the Labour Party doing a lot of thinking about, you know, the phrase I used earlier, the squeezed middle. And I know it's not fashionable to sort of get your tiny violin out for people that want to go on a nice holiday
in the summer, and they want to, you know, have a slightly nicer bottle of wine when they have dinner on a Saturday night. But these people, they are a part of our society. They are important. And we should look after their interests too.
Thank you very much, Ollie, for coming on the programme. Ollie Dugmore, executive editor of the New Statesman magazine. I mean, me and Ollie very much on the same page. Maybe you want to say it's absolutely fair. Rachel Reeves is right. That if you go to university and you get them all the benefits, such as they are these days, of a university degree, then yeah, you should pay more. And then you should pay 8% interest on that extra bit that you... is it fair? I mean, you're going to struggle to convince me, to be honest, but let's have a conversation about it. 0345 6060973. If you don't think it is fair, if you're one of the young workers, young graduates, maybe you're a student now, being absolutely clobbered by these loans, this debt, these interest rates, then let me know what it means for you. Let me know what it's like having to deal with that, what it comes at the cost of, what you have to sacrifice as a result, and whether you think it's fair. Ben Kentish here on LBC. The time for now, 12:18.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They have fatal incompetence.
Straight to the point.
What is the problem they've got over there?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The country's going backwards. Growth down. Energy prices up.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Hiya. Kenny the hamster here. Beloved pet of Doug and Carol Brookbank. Now, I've got to hand it to Doug and Kazza. They're doing school pickups, jobs, trips to the supermarket, and still find time to get healthy. Apparently, it's down to some NHS Healthy Choices quiz. Only took them 5 minutes to do, then gave them a simple plan to get started.
Come on, kids.
Total amazeballs!
Take your first little step to healthy. Search NHS Healthy Choices quiz to get a score and a plan that's right for you.
Yeah, I'm one of their biggest fans. I've got all the vinyl. First saw them at a tiny little place in Camden. Then as festival headliners a few years back. Oh, now that was special. So there's no chance I'd miss their world tour. In London, Lisbon and LA. Good thing I've been saving.
From down the road to across the globe, saving gets you there. Join the millions of people already saving with Ennis and I.
Woo!
Visit ennisandi.com.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It's 12:19. Your call's coming in about whether the current system for funding universities is fair, which if you're not familiar with, it is £9,500 per year. I paid £3,200. I left university with a debt of about, I think it's about 20, 25 grand when you include the living cost loans and so on. That came out my salary for a very, very long time. Today, students will leave with debt several times that, if they're lucky. And that's unless they're doing a 5-year, 7-year degree, in which case it will be probably well over £100,000. And you have to pay that back when you start earning above £28,000, which is significantly less than the average wage. So even if you're literally a low-paid worker, not much more than the minimum wage, you have to start paying that off. That comes out your salary every month, even if you're only just making ends meet. Only just managing to pay the rent and the bills. And it's not just you pay the loan back. The whole time, whether or not you're paying it back, whether you're ill, off sick, on maternity leave, paternity leave, whatever it might be, you're getting hit at an interest rate that is 3% above the rate of inflation. And Rachel Reeves, a Labour Chancellor, I said again, supposedly the party of workers, thinks it's fair. The party of workers or the party of pensioners? Not clear to me. Elliot's calling from Bournemouth to talk about whether it really is fair. Elliot.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, morning.
First time caller, so a bit nervous.
Oh, but, welcome, Elliot. Good to have you with us. Thanks for
my situation. Mm. So I'm a registered nurse. I finished my studies a couple of years ago, and my student debt is over £100,000, which is pretty insane.
£100,000?
Yes. So oh, the reason mine ended up so high, so I was studying during the pandemic, and it happened, you know, really broke out badly during my third year. And I was working for a care home group at the time, and I decided, you know what, actually, the right thing for me to do is step back, use my skills where I'm needed. And I worked with a regional team there in responding to the COVID outbreak. And because of that, you know, I had to step away from uni for that year, take a gap year. And all this time, you know, from the second you start studying, the interest is accruing. And so by the time I've gone back, paid for the extra year and qualified, you know, I checked my balance and it's just over £100,000. It's just indefensible.
I mean, that's just a ridiculous sum of money, Elliot, isn't it? And you're being penalised for doing the right thing and trying to help people, effectively.
Exactly. I mean, I calculated it at the interest rate at the time. I would have to be earning about £80,000 just to break even on the interest payments.
Just break that down for me, Elliot. Just to break even in what sense?
So just to cover the interest that was being added on every year.
You'd have to be earning £80,000.
Yeah.
Do you know what the interest rate that you're paying is?
I mean, it changes because it's, you know, a variable.
Linked to inflation,
Exactly, linked to inflation. So when I checked it at the time, that's what it was. I try and avoid checking it now.
So it's what's inflation at the moment? It's about 2.5%. So you're probably still playing 5% or something like that.
Yeah.
So is your debt going up and up and up, even if you even while you're paying it off, you get more and more is getting added?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, not even while you're just paying it off, while you're studying as well.
Elliot, sorry if I missed it, but do you know how much you pay per month in loan repayments?
I think I pay about 120, 150 at the moment.
Okay, and can you absorb that? Is that sort of...
I mean, I can, but it's because, you know, I mean, looking at the amount when I qualified, I looked at, you know, my prospects and I thought, well, actually, you know, I could go and work for the NHS, but money's going to be poor. So it pushed me into private, which I've done well in, and I'm earning a decent salary. But, you know, a part of me thinks, well, actually, maybe they need to look at, that's a loss, surely, to the system. I mean, if they'd have said, you know, come and work for the NHS, and, you know, we will take that into consideration with your student debt, you know, I don't know, work for the NHS for 5 years and there'll be a repayment or something like that. Surely that would be more benefit to the government than pushing me into private.
Well, you used to get bursaries, didn't you? Nurses used to get bursaries, and now you get £100,000 of debt. for the crime of wanting to help treat ill people. It's just... What do you make of Rachel who said it's fair, Elliot?
I just think, you know, it's clear she's pandering to a certain voting base.
That's which is who?
The older age pensioners. Plan 2 came into effect in, what, 2012? Mm-hmm. So the amount of voters that's affecting is minimal. And that's, you know, what it looks like. It looks like it's just going for the largest voting base.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree, given that this is the same Chancellor who, even when Conservative MPs are saying, look, you know, the triple lock on pensions has got to go, we can't keep affording, and it's not fair, because it's just funnelling billions and billions to a lot of people who don't need it. Rachel Reeves says, no, the triple lock is fair. It's really important that multimillionaire pensioners keep getting more of taxpayers' money every year, along with the pensioners, of course, who do need it. She thinks that's fair, and she also thinks that you having 100 grand debt and paying more in interest than you're actually paying off per month is fair as well.
Yeah, the mind boggles.
I say again, what is the point of a Labour Chancellor with those priorities?
Yeah.
Elliot, I think we're on the same page. Lovely to talk to you for the first time. Really, really interesting. Thank you, Elliot. Austin's in Norbury in South London, following up on that. Hello, Austin. Morning.
Hi, Ben. I just want to say congratulations on becoming a father.
Oh, that's kind of you, Austin. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Congratulations. I love your show. I listen to it a lot. Anyway, I actually am a teacher, right? So I've worked in secondary and I currently work in further education. I got a free grant from 1982 to 87 when I did a language degree and did teacher training. I fully agree with what you've said.
Do you think I'm being harsh, Austin, on Rachel? No, okay.
I'm going to go through my points with you because I know you've got to listen to a lot of people. Number one, Nick Clegg's a hypocrite. I can't stand him. He went to work for Facebook. SDPs, well, the Liberal Democrats, they've got a lot to answer for because it happened with them years ago.
Yeah. I don't want to jump in on you too much, but just on that, it says something, though, doesn't it, when Nick Clegg is standing up for students and Rachel Reeves isn't? If Nick Clegg's the defence of students, my goodness.
No, I agree with you.
Something's gone wrong.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, Rachel Reeves, I'm a Labour supporter. I'm going to join this week and Friday when all my work's finished. And I'm going to be emailing Keir Starmer, Steve Reid, my local MP, and Rachel Reeves. She needs to go. I agree with what you're saying, because she's mucked up business. She's now... She's, teaching been, it's just disgusting with the students. I got a free education. Why are they paying so much money? I don't understand.
She got a free education.
Yeah, she did. And she's got to go because the public, A, they don't like her. I was a supporter for her until I heard what you said, and I fully agree with you. So I'm emailing them. And basically, I think what we need in this country, actually, is cross-party working across the NHS education. It's too polarised. It's getting really stupid, I think. But I fully agree with you.
And you sort of expect it from the Conservatives, to be fair, Austin, in a way. I'm not saying it was the right thing to do, but the Conservatives, you know, they've always, their base is older generations. That's who they stand up for. They've got to find some money from somewhere. It's younger people who generally don't vote Tory who foot the bill. I'm not saying it's right or fair. It's not, but it's kind of how politics has always worked. Labour claims to be on the side of hardworking people. What about hardworking young graduates who Rachel Reeves think it's fair to clobber with 8% interest rates and like Elliot, debts of 100 grand.
I fully agree with you, Ben. And I think I'm actually from, I'm middle class now, but I was working class. And I actually worked with people around benefits. I used to help people get their benefits years ago in the 90s. I think it's disgusting. And I think she's going to go. They're going to have to get rid of her.
You think she'll have to sort of fall on a sword?
Yes, I do. Because I was listening yesterday about, you know, the business, you know, the pubs and the club, not the pubs.
She made a spectacular mess of that.
I actually think I've given her a chance, but now she's got to go. I'm sorry.
Austin, I mean, I can't think of a single thing she's done that's gone well, to be quite
honest
with you.
No, I agree with you. I fully agree with you, Ben. And you're very reasonable. And when I listen to you, I just fully agree. She's got to go. But what are they going to do?
I don't know. I don't know. And I think her and Keir Starmer, they're so sort of close politically. They're close personally as well, by the way. I don't know. I don't know if she will go. I don't know if he feels he can sack her. I'm not sure.
She will go, and he'll have to go because I won't go into it now because it's not relevant. But I'm going to complain about Andy Burnham, how they've treated him.
You think he should have been allowed to run?
Yeah, but I think they need to bring in Jonathan Ashworth.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's very good. But I just think Rachel Reeves, what planet is she on?
Well, politically as well, you know. Labour's hemorrhaging support of young voters right now. Young graduates, a lot of them, to the Greens and the Lib Dems. And up pops the political mastermind that is Rachel Reeves once again to tell those young graduates that the massive debts that they've been saddled with, that her generation never had to pay, and the punitive interest rates that they're coughing through, that they're having to cough up to pay as well, is fair. Explain to me the political strategy of that. Alienate your core voters, young people. Further drive away from you the wavering young graduates who are thinking, do you know what, quite like a look at Zach Polanski, or actually the Lib Dems are looking all right. It's just utterly stupid politically, as well as morally wrong, if you ask me. And, you know, that applies to quite a lot of what this Chancellor's done, hasn't it? I mean, look at taking away disabled people's benefits. You look at refusing to listen to the backlash about winter fuel payments. Morally indefensible, politically stupid. Quite a lot of things that this Treasury is doing. I think, you know, you can apply that description to. Austin, lovely to talk to you. Thank you again for the kind words. Will you call in again soon?
Yeah, of course.
Good.
One more thing before you go.
Yeah, of course.
I just want to say that they're alienating young people. I watched Newsnight tonight and I saw Martin Lewis. I couldn't believe the debt that these young people are in. And there was a doctor on there saying how much debt he was in. It's not acceptable.
Look, poor Elliot. £100,000 of debt because he decided to dedicate his life to helping treat people in the NHS as a qualified nurse. And that's what we get. And Rachel Reeves' argument, oh, well, he benefited from going to university. The point she misses, the very basic, quite obvious point she misses is so do the rest of us benefit from Elliot going to university. Because I don't know about you, but I'd much rather be treated with a nurse who's done a nursing degree at university than one who hasn't. Does Rachel Reeves not realise that? Does she want doctors who haven't gone to medical school? Does she want architects? Does she want people designing skyscrapers who haven't actually done a 7-year architecture degree because they're too put off by the fees? I mean, it's just utterly stupid, to be quite frank with you. Austin, again, thank you very much indeed for the call. More of your thoughts to come in just a moment. Plus,
We reveal the largest haul of stolen tools yet as the Met Police find £2 million worth of equipment in one house. I'm LBC's Henry Riley with the exclusive.
Bringing the details of that story straight on to news headlines as well. 12:31 the time. Here's Darrell Jackson.
Donald Trump has warned Iran time is running out to reach a deal over its nuclear program. The US president says a massive armada is heading to the Middle East following the steady build-up of US military forces in the Gulf. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has arrived in China for a three-day visit, the first by a British Prime Minister for 8 years. Sir Keir Starmer is seeking to strengthen trading and cultural ties between the two countries. And the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiries found physical, sexual and emotional abuse was allowed to take place for decades at Fettes College in Edinburgh. The failure to protect children from the 1950s to the 1980s has been described by the inquiry chair as shameful. LBC weather, fog lingering in central and eastern areas later, mostly cloudy with the odd bright spell in places. Some light rain in northeast Scotland and the southwest, a high of 10 degrees.
This is LBC.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
You want £1 million.
I'd love £1 million.
So you enter the birthday draw and you think of a way to spend £1 million.
I'd deposit regularly into a retirement fund that safely tracks the market.
It's a lucky day and you win the birthday draw.
I can't believe it!
And you buy a snake and a superbike instead.
Yeah, baby!
Is it your lucky day? For your chance to win £1 million, just search the birthday draw and enter now. From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
It's not easy being a clamp stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself.
Hi, Clampy. How's it going?
Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely.
Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
This is LBC with Ben Kentish. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 12:34. Just looking at when Rachel Reeves went to university, it's possible she did have to pay £1,000 a year in fees. In which case, if she thinks it's fair that today's students pay 9.5, then quite simply, she could do the same, couldn't she? She could say, well, actually, I only paid £1,000. If the value of my education is really 9.5, because that's what we're charging today's students, then the other £8,500, I'll donate it to the Treasury for the 3 or 4 years that I was at university. That's only fair, isn't it? We'll see if she does that. Alan's in Finchley to talk about the student loan system, Alan, and whether it's fair on young people. Morning to you.
Good morning. Hi. Well, first of all, I don't think the majority of universities are worth a light. I think we should stop the university system in the main. My reason is as follows. I'm a 76-year-old chartered accountant. I left school when I was 16. I was a qualified accountant by the age of 21, with no debt and earning very nice money. And by the age of 24, I was buying my own home in London. I had friends who were becoming surveyors, valuers. There was a couple of girls who became nurses. Lots of professions were coming out. In those days, it was called articles of clerkship. Nowadays, I think you call it apprenticeships. Mm-hmm. But in the main, we were all very happy. We were all still widely educated, but we had no debt and were earning big money. You know, a lot of the people who go to university now, their BAs and BSCs, whatever, are useless. They have to go on for MAs. So that takes them up to about, I don't know, 25, 26, before they can even start.
About 21, 22.
What, with an MA?
Yeah, it's about a year normally in a master's.
Okay. So they still got to then start finding jobs and start earning, and they got all that debt.
Yeah.
What's the point?
I agree with you, Alan, that a lot of people have been sent to university and told they should go who actually might have benefited more from just starting out in the world of work or doing an apprenticeship or a vocational qualification. The issue is they were told to do that by the government. the last Labour government said, right, 50% of you, we want you to go to university. That's the problem.
Yeah, it is.
It's not the young people's fault.
Yeah.
And now having done what the government told them they should do and what the school's saying, you've got to go to university and everyone's got to go to university, they're now being clobbered with tens of thousands of pounds, hundreds of thousands of pounds of debt.
Yeah, and it's not only that. That debt, I would imagine, in quite a few cases, leads on to some kind of mental stress, mental problems.
Absolutely. And also, if you're from a deprived background, you think, well, actually, I'd quite like to become a doctor. But actually, that's what's that? That's 5-year course at £9,500 a year. So you're looking there at the best part of, you know, getting on for £60,000. That's before you factor in any living costs.
Yeah.
So I'd like to be a doctor, but I'm going to be, what, 120, 140 grand in debt. No thanks. I'll go and do something else instead. Does Rachel Reeves not see the issue with being people from poor backgrounds being put off from going to university because of this system?
I don't think they see how life really works. They've all been to they've gone through their university things. I don't know how half of them have got to Oxford and Cambridge. I don't understand that one. You know, it's completely weird when you listen to them talking.
Well, they let me in, so God knows, Alan, they let anybody in, I think, these days.
Yeah. The whole system needs to be revamped, and quite easily. So if you bring back apprenticeships and articles, within, say, 5 or 6 years...
Yeah.
You'd get rid of a lot of the university debt.
What would you, the people who are at university, what would be a fairer way of them paying their fees, do you think?
That one, once they're in the system, I don't know. That's a bit like taking a credit card debt. Once you've got that debt and you've spent it, how do you get rid of the interest charge?
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
I think they should have a graduate tax. So, you know, I take the point, if you are a graduate, yes, you're generally a bit better off, you've probably benefited, you should pay for your fees and you know, rather than everybody else having to pay to send you there. But the way it's done now, with these sort of loans and these interest rates, where some people pay 2% and some people pay 8%, it's just ridiculous. And the fact that Rachel Reeves can't see that is... I'm lost for words. Alan, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much, Neil. Let's talk to Kieran, a new caller in Shrewsbury, Kieran. I get told off whichever one I say.
Depends where you're from, Ben. I say Shrewsbury, but I don't know. Might just be me.
My football team's playing up your way this weekend. I don't think I'm going, but I have been there before. Shrewsbury, Kieran. I'll stop waffling on. What made you pick up the phone? It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for discussing this, Ben. Really appreciate it. So I graduated in 2017. I was a law graduate and I'm now a qualified solicitor. So this year alone, I think I repaid around £3,500 through my salary, which was net, so after salary. And I think interest repayments added on top of my loan was about £3,200.
So out of the £3,500, £3,200 was just the interest payments?
Yeah, so I paid off £3,500. They've added £3,200 of interest, so my principal sum reduced by only £300.
Wow. Do you mind if I ask what you earn, Kieran? Feel free to tell me to mind my own business. But...
No. So I'm about 3 years qualified now. I earn about, in excess of about £85,000. Mm-hmm. So, I've done really well for myself and I have absolutely no regrets about going to university.
Yeah.
I guess just, it's really difficult to stomach, when you look at your graduate loan, you're earning good money and £400 a month comes off my salary net. It's just quite hard.
But of that £400, you're only paying £300 a year of it. You're actually paying the loan off. The rest is all interest.
Yeah, exactly. And, I think I worked out I'd be, over the life of the loan, I'd be paying around, £250,000.
For a three-year degree that Rachel Reeves paid £3,000 for.
Yeah, £50,000 loan in total, when I left university. And, I had to go on and do a training contract, which was an additional, 2-3 years where I was earning, relatively low sums of money whilst I was training. Then during that time, I'm not earning enough to pay back that student loan and the interest just keeps compounding and compounding. And you get to the point where, you're just wondering, am I going to pay this back or should I actually look at maybe going to a high street lender, taking out a private loan and repaying it that way?
It gets wiped, doesn't it, when you get to the age of 40, I think.
I think mine is 30 years from the date I graduated. I'm not 100%. So
if you might be on plan, is it plan two, do you think?
Yeah, so I'm on the one that, you know, the infamous plan two.
You're right, 30 years. So actually, you will probably have to pay off. I dread to think how much, Kieran, in interest over all those years.
Yeah, and I have absolutely no complaints about paying for my tuition fees. Yeah. You know, I agree, I should be paying for my tuition fees. It was a choice to go to university, and mm-hmm. that burden should not be put on the everyday taxpayer.
So you pay the 27, what were your fees, 9,000 a year or so?
9,000 a year, yeah.
You pay the 27 grand happily, but you don't want to pay £250,000 because of the interest rates.
Yeah, you know, I had to take loans on top, you know, maintenance loans to actually live while studying, you know, so I've left with quite a substantial of debt. And you know, like I said, I don't have any concerns about repaying that sum of money. What I take issue with is just the interest rate so astronomical.
Do you know the mistake you made, though, Kieran? Do you know where you went wrong here?
Go
on. You didn't have wealthy enough parents, mate. Because if you'd had multi-millionaire mum and dad, you wouldn't have a loan to pay off. They would have just paid your fees outright.
You know, my parents were, you know, very hard-working, working-class individuals. They put me through the best schools they could.
Yep.
You know, and I managed to go to university and get to where I wanted to be.
I'm being facetious, but I'm doing it deliberately to make the point that this is a tax that is beyond regressive. That if you have parents that are so wealthy, and mine couldn't, and most people's couldn't, that they just pay your fees outright, this is a tax you never have to pay. These interest charges are only payments that you make, you have to pay if your parents can't afford to pay your fees, right? That's the injustice of it.
Completely, and I've got lots of friends in that exact situation. You know, they didn't have debt because their parents just paid their fees up front.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, you know, my earnings are deducted for £400 a month, which could mm-hmm. be going into the economy, you know, through my own personal expenditure. But instead, it's just going towards, you know, I feel like we're just mortgaging future generations, because who's going to pay this debt if it just keeps spiraling?
And as you say, that the money that, you know, that you're spending in interest payments, you could be spending in pubs and bars, you could be buying a house. This is the Chancellor who wants growth. How much growth would be unleashed if this whole generation of young graduates had a bit more disposable income to pump into the economy?
Yeah, and you know, I think Rachel Reeves needs to think about this in the sense that, you know, I'm still a young person, but I'm a politically engaged 30-year-old now. I do vote. I vote every general election. I vote in local elections, and you know, people my age will vote with their feet.
Did you vote Labour?
I did vote Labour for the first time ever.
Would you still?
I don't think I would, no. You know, I would be interested to hear from parties that would actually have proactive policies that deal with these sorts of things. You know, it's not particularly encouraging when Rachel Reeves comes on and says it's fair. Completely fair. Yeah. I mean, it's brainless.
It really gets my back up, Kieran, as somebody, you know, who went to university and you know, had parents who weren't able to just give me tens of thousands of pounds to pay for it, that you might end up paying £250,000 in what is ultimately tax, let's call it what it is, to the Treasury, yeah. that your richer friends will never have to pay. And a Labour Chancellor thinks that is fair.
Yeah.
I'm with you. And you're right. You and a lot of people will say, well, I put my trust in Labour because I thought finally they might be the government stood up for young people. And you are absolutely within your rights to feel totally let down by them.
Yeah, completely.
Lovely to talk to you, Kieran. Thank you very, very much indeed for calling for the first time. Hope we'll speak again very soon. You can tell it winds me up. I am angry. I'm angry on behalf of a whole generation of young people like Kieran, who thought, you know what? The Tories have betrayed us and neglected us for the best part of 14 years. Maybe this lot. This lot that says it's on the side of young people and working people and wants to make life better for this generation, maybe they'll finally do something differently. What have they done? Put tuition fees up even more and defended a system that even Nick Clegg, the bloke who got into office and lied about, you know, and went back on his promise and trebled tuition fees, even Nick Clegg now says is unfair. But Rachel Reeves thinks it's completely fine. If Kieran and Elliot and others haven't convinced you otherwise, then I don't know what would, to be quite honest. I'd love to play their calls to Rachel Reeves and just say, Chancellor, what is just about a nurse having to pay 100 grand a debt? What is just about Elliot potentially paying £250,000 just because his parents weren't wealthy enough to pay his fees outright for him? How is that fair? What would be fairer That's what we haven't really touched on, I guess, this conversation. What would be a better way of doing it? If we agree, and lots of us seem to, that this is unjust, what's the improvement? What's the change that would be needed to make it a better system? 03456060973. More to come, and we'll look at that latest on that stunning haul of stolen tools by the police today. It is 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Claims of increased church-going by young people may be misleading, but what does your faith mean to you? And centrist ideas are no longer wanted in the Tory party. Is moderate thinking now dead and buried across British politics?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
It's time to scale up that fishmonger business, Anne. With free day-to-day online banking from Virgin Money, you'll be a big fish in no time. Now that's a real catch of the day. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus fees apply for chaps and international payments. Terms and exclusions apply. Backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
I'm Leah and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right and my GP referred me to the CDC. Had some blood tests done and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for business. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
Just before we talk more about student loans with Julius in Weybridge, let's get the very latest on the news that there are 46,000 reported cases of tool theft every single year, with the Met describing tackling that as a priority. And LBC's exclusive revelation today of the details of the biggest discovery of stolen equipment yet in the UK. It all tracks back to a house of multiple occupancy is in Ilford. And Henry Riley, LBC's reporter, has the exclusive.
On average, a tool is stolen every 12 minutes in the UK, most frequently pinched from the vans of tradespeople. Police have been saying for years that they will crack down on this criminal practice, and today we can reveal that the Met uncovered up to £2 million worth of stolen tools and equipment at just one site in Ilford. Now, that's the largest stash of stolen tools ever discovered in the UK. Inspector Mark Connolly from the Met tells me what they found.
That ranges from, you know, high-value pieces of equipment which are owned by big companies all the way down to the smaller trades where they've had their vans broken into, tools stolen from site, and you know, we're able to identify those pieces of equipment and we're able to clearly see that they've had, you know, serial numbers scratched out.
Now that's the equivalent of 10 lorry loads of nicked tools. Some were taken from a site in Tilbury in Essex from contractors. Inspector Connolly said the company Balfour Beatty reported that high value equipment had been taken from one of their sites, and trackers on some of the stolen goods eventually led officers to the address. Shweb Awan is a gas engineer from Romford and an anti-tool theft campaigner, and he told LBC News the site was full of tools with six or seven rooms filled with stolen kit, and told me that some were stolen before the pandemic.
These tools dated from 2018-19 when they were reported stolen, so this operation obviously has been going for quite a long time, and it was so brazen as well, to be honest with you, because they're selling stuff with the markings on them. They don't care.
Two suspects were arrested at the scene, a third individual identified and arrested at a different address, which is believed to have had more stolen items. The suspects are thought to be part of an organised criminal group who are involved in reselling these stolen items. Officers are now working to identify the items and reunite them with their rightful owners.
LBC's reporter Henry Riley with that quite shocking exclusive. Right, 12:51 at the time. Let's talk to Julius in Weybridge about the student loan system. Graduates being hit with massive interest rates, Julius, paying back way more than they ever borrowed in the first place. Is it fair, as Rachel Reeves says it is? What do you think?
Evening, Ben.
Morning.
Well?
I'm really well, Julius, actually. Well, thank you for asking. How about yourself?
Are you the gentleman recently with a family?
I've always had a family, but I've now got a child. I've now got a little 4 week and 2 day old boy. Yes, that is true.
I've not spoken to you since, and congratulations, and still counting the days, huh?
guilty as charged, Julius. He's gorgeous, honestly. He's a joy to the world.
I'm hearing Mum's well as well.
Mum's recovering really well from a quite difficult birth, so thank you very much indeed.
I'm pleased she's recovering, because that can be traumatic.
It was challenging, but she's doing great. Thank you so much for asking.
Well, I mean, she married you, I guess.
She's had far worse to put up with than a C-section.
Thanks, Alfred. His dad. All right, okay. Now listen, the other thing I have to say here, I'm sorry that the matter's obviously gone round to Henry's house to find the tools, but
Henry Riley is secretly is behind this spate of tool theft. It's an incredible disguise. He pretends to report on it, but he's secretly the kingpin, Julius. You're right.
It came across like that on his segment, but more importantly, according to Nick Abbott, they need to go around to David Cameron's shed, don't they? Because of course, that's where all the tools are.
It's where all those students' interest rates have gone, probably.
Well, now, that's what we're supposed to be talking about, isn't it? And these poor students, here's the thing. I was lucky enough to go through uni back in the day with a grant. Mm. I also had a bit of help with a scholarship and a sponsorship. And I should say, I don't recall there ever being a conversation about my getting into debt. How lucky am I? Mm. What I'm hearing with this cohort, frankly, from experience, is a recipe for intergenerational ill health and mental health.
And inequality.
Well, it's worse than that. I actually think technically it's usury. I'd like to know who set these companies up and who's benefiting from this. And I'm quite surprised that between them, they haven't got a few, I'm talking about the students here who graduated, they haven't got a few lawyers and student unions and, you know, forensic, what are they called, accountants, and don't bring a class action about this, because it just feels like they've been set up to be scammed, is frankly.
I don't think it's illegal. I think it's just government policy. Well, and it might be unjust, and it might be unfair.
I think usury is illegal. And from what you've been describing about the interest rates, the way they're being applied, and the nature of being applied even when people aren't earning, etc., it sounds to me as though we've got laws that cover that in the commercial sector.
Well, it goes back to the government. That's the issue. That's why Rachel Reeves is so keen to defend it, because she's...
Who are not above the law, is
true.
The point.
No, true. I hear you, Julius. I mean, I don't know. I suspect that it might be unfair, but presumably, well, maybe it's worth a legal challenge. I don't know. But it's been going on so long, I think it's probably not unlawful, but it's absolutely unjust, if you ask me.
I suspect it needs to be challenged, and
the problem is, you know, the students don't have any power. They don't have the kind of lobbying groups. They don't have the campaigns behind them. They're cash-strapped students. The idea of launching a legal challenge, you know, it's what people who frankly have more financial resources are able to do. But it's a lovely idea, Julius. Maybe they could crowdfund it or something. Julius, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you. And thank you for the kind words as well. Really, really appreciate it. Akis is calling from Bristol. Hi, Akis.
Hello. Hi. Good evening.
Evening.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to add, actually, it's a brilliant conversation, and thanks for bringing it up. So I'm personally Greek, so I moved from Greece to the UK. I'm just trying to save time by giving you a bit of a background, right? To study in the UK, I get a student loan. I wasn't given any allowance. Right, so I was only giving a student loan, which half of it will be funded by the EU, right, because back then UK was still in the EU. Right, so interest is a plan B, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation with another caller, and that means that the interest is getting added regardless if you're working, regardless if you're earning, regardless if you haven't finished that degree, to be honest with you, because it tells you per year, you see. So, and then I personally studied medical sciences, which then means you have to do a placement year in the NHS in order to get registered, in order to be able to practice, which then you're expected to do that for free. So you're expected to work for the NHS for a year, 40 hours a week, mm-hmm. with no protected time to do your attestation portfolio for free, just in order you can do your job after you've been charged with interest for a student loan for education, which, you know, I don't know, maybe because I'm Greek, I don't know, but for me, education sounds essential. Sounds something should be provided. Surely we want educated.
Yes, exactly.
Surely we want a proactive society, a proactive country, right? We don't want people that they're not able to do their taxes. We don't, you know, we need people to be able to be functional.
The way Rachel Reeves talk about it, is it's as if it's a selfish thing to do. You benefited it. You should pay for it. Whereas, as you absolutely rightly point out, all of us benefit from having highly educated right. doctors or lawyers or architects or nurses or, you know, teachers or whatever the profession is. A better educated country is better for us all. The Chancellor cannot see that. It's baffling.
No, it's outrageous. And the fact, like you said earlier, that if my parents were rich, if my parents were millionaires, I would never have to deal with this stress. I would never have to deal with these numbers. It sounds as if a Labour government says that sounds fair to be a specific educational taxation to the poor population that dares to want to educate themselves.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. It's a punishment.
Labour government, like it's well
it's supposedly a Labour government. It's not behaving much like one when it comes to young people,
right.
is it?
Right, yes. I think that's the main problem here. None of us can really digest that because, you know, we'd expect it from... Yeah, we wouldn't expect that from Labour. No, I will keep it there, I think.
Thank you, Akis. I'm sorry I'm out of time, but I really appreciate your call. And yeah, it goes back to what I was saying about it being politically stupid as well as, I think, morally indefensible. The way that they are absolutely continuing to rip off young hard-pressed, hard-working graduates who've done the right thing, and now the Chancellor says it's absolutely fair that they are. Thank you, Akis. I'm sorry to Michael and others I didn't get time to speak to tonight, but we speak again, I hope, tomorrow at 10 p.m. I'll be back with you then. Tonight's show, as always, on Catch Up on Global Player and the brand new LBC app. You can get those right now for free from your app store. Thank you for your company. Always a pleasure this time in the morning. 4 o'clock on LBC. Ian Payne is here right now. Richard Spur.
Good morning. Claims of increased church attendance, particularly amongst young people, may be misleading, according to the latest research. But are you still a regular churchgoer? What role does your faith play in your life? And have you gained, lost or changed your faith at some point in your time? First, though, centrist ideas are no longer wanted in the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch has said, arguing that One Nation Tories or others who have qualms about her rightward direction for the party, quote, need to get out of the way. So this morning, with the Conservative leader also saying that the Tories have moved to the right every day since she became leader, are the moderate beliefs and policies of the centre ground now dead and buried across British politics as a whole? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Iran says its armed forces are ready to respond after Donald Trump warned time's running out to agree a deal on Tehran's nuclear program. The US president says a massive naval force is moving towards the region and can act with speed and violence if talks fail. It follows weeks of deadly protests inside Iran and mixed signals from Washington about whether it would intervene. Rob McCare, a former British ambassador to Iran, told LBC there are three main choices if the US does choose military action.
There's action against the nuclear program, or perhaps more importantly now, the ballistic missile program. There's action against the security or the organs of the state that have been conducting the repression, and that would be linked to the protests. Or there's leadership targets, which would be perhaps in the hope more of engineering some sort of regime change or regime overthrow.
The Prime Minister is expected to discuss business and trade when he meets China's president today. Sir Keir Starmer's joined by British firms in Beijing, where he's hoping to build bridges. The trip comes despite national security concerns, with the Chinese accused of spying and attempting to interfere in UK public life.
Water bills will rise by £33 a year for the average household in England and Wales from April. That equates to an increase of around 5.4%. Campaigners are concerned customers are paying for the price for years of underinvestment while pollution continues. Stuart Colville from Water UK, though, says it is needed.
We know that bill rises are never, ever welcome, but they are paying for some really vital investment. Today's announcement about bills going up slightly from April will see that money ring-fenced so they can only be spent on the things that matter for the environment and for customers.
The Environment Agency is warning people to stay vigilant as the risk of flooding continues, with more heavy rain forecast across the southwest.